Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
This is published at Atlanta Black Star, Mr. Nick Childs. Beating sexual abuse of Illinois inmates detailed in lawsuit reveals torture black men subjected to in American prisons. I'm skipping down midway through the report. That as an example of the torture, the black inmates had to endure a strip search in front of female officers, touch their genitals and spread their buttocks, and then use the same hand to open their mouths. They would also have to march from their housing units to the gym at the facility with their heads on the backs of the prisoners ahead of them in line so that one man's genitals were in direct contact with the next man's buttocks. If they broke the formation, they would be violently attacked by the guards, according to the suit. The guards called this nuts to butts. What is the, I think you were just talking about sexual abuse, state-sanctioned violence against black people, black males in particular?
Look, one, send me that article, definitely, because I want to read it. But this is why this is funny. So, I'm writing this book, The Man Not, and the second chapter of this book is on Eldridge Cleaver's lost manuscript, The Book of Lies. It's something that I found in some archives that has never been written about. People don't even know that this exists. And one of the things that Eldridge Cleaver points out about the prison industrial complex is that it's a hedonistic arena for white people's sexual pleasure. So what he says is that he says that, white people know that if you put men together in a prison who have been oppressed and told that they cannot embody manhood because they can't have a white woman, then what you do is you create a sexual anxiety that tries to seek out the sexual domination of other men. And he says it's because of this homoerotic nature of the prison industrial complex that white people use black bodies for sexual entertainment. It's a type of pornography for them. So when you mention this story, I think of all the cases of male-on-male rape. I think of all the cases of black men talking about domination and rape from the prison staff, including, and this is the part that's the most disturbing, including white female staff. There's a lot of law journals that are now talking about, and even studies. So the simple study that was talking about the rates of rape between men and women being the same gets that because she includes the prison population. And that's, of course, dominated, even the juvenile population, dominated by young black and brown boys. So you have a history of this eroticism involved with black male bodies and brown bodies that never gets talked about in terms of the academic discourse. When we think of incarceration, we think of it as simple violence. But there's a kind of sexualization that happens to black men, a kind of performance of homoeroticism that happens that's intimately tied up with how black bodies are treated, which is one of the reasons that this idea that black men can be raped, not only, in jails, but now we know, throughout history, I think I mentioned before, this is Thomas Foster's work, that because black men have been raped by white men and white women, that this becomes an aspect of racialized violence. And it is, and Gus, I'll tell you that it is incredibly hard to talk about this aspect of anti-blackness within the university. Because the minute that you talk about it, it implicates white men and white women in a way that is offensive to disciplines itself. In other words, because we've defined racism largely as a heteronormative project where men attack men, white men rape white women, and white women largely become, you know, these passive, you know, background subjects, you know, we don't want to talk about the actions of sexuality towards male bodies. And the story you read is a perfect example of that. And this is something that Cleaver understood. Cleaver understood that, look, if you put black men in a position where they're going to be dominated, they're dominated not because of their race, but because of their sex. It is white men's homoerotic fantasy. It's their attempt to overcome the savageness of the black male body that attracts them to them. And the thing about it, we accept this on a heteronormative basis. Right, we laugh at the idea that black athletes have white cheerleaders. We laugh at the idea that rich black men get white women. So we accept the same kind of eroticism or exoticism when we talk about white women's attractiveness to black men. But then we completely dismiss it because we don't think that homoeroticism or homosexuality have anything to do with racism when you talk about the relationship that the white male body has to black male bodies. You know, and this is why things like that at the prison happen. This is why the UN has report after report about prison rape in the United States and black men's victimization by giving the false the numbers of exonerations and, you know, false convictions, but nobody wants to talk about it. And it's sad because this is really us cutting down history to fit within certain disciplinary, you know, lenses, and that gets passed down into society because we're not educating children about slavery, including the rape of black men. We're not educating people or students about slavery, including, you know, the sexualization of black male bodies, and it's part of the reason of the castration during lynching. We simply hold on to these mythologies that are based in narrow heteronormative myths and disciplinary politics like feminism that are essentializing certain relationships between bodies and missing out on the terror that black men and boys and black people generally experience at the hands of white supremacist institutions and peoples.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's day, Friday, January 27th, 2017. So I have been told. The audio segment at the beginning of the clip, the great Dr. Tommy Curry. He's been a guest on the program multiple times over the years. We had to start our debut study session on the delectable Negro, human consumption, and homoeroticism within U.S. slave culture. We had to begin the debut session with Dr. Tommy Curry because he's the person who mentioned this book to begin with. It's been some years now, but he first mentioned it back on the cows a few years back, and then he's referenced it a few other times in subsequent visits. I think I even read a portion, passage from the book and allowed him to respond to it on one of his visits to the program. But even though he didn't say the book's title in that segment, what you heard gets right to the core of a lot of the main points that we're going to hear about in The Delectable Negro. Really excited to get started on the book. This was tied for top votes with Gwen Ifill, The Breakthrough. And now that we've finished that up, I think this is going to be a much more enjoyable read. Mr. Woodard is a black male. Without further ado, we will get started. Context of White Supremacy, The Delectable Negro, Human Consumption and Homoeroticism Within U.S. Slave Culture. This is audio segment number one, one of our listeners doing the honors of narrating the text.
Introduction. Master, eated me when I was meat. In the summer of 2007, I visited Somerset Place in Creswell, North Carolina. At one point, Somerset Place, a historical restored plantation, was the most successful plantation in North Carolina, and its owner, Josiah Collins III, one of the largest slaveholders in the state. It is now a state historic site sitting over 100 acres of lush forest and wetland. My party and I arrived early one Saturday morning, parked near the overseer's quarters, and walked the red cobblestone road down the center of the plantation, past the stocks, past the smokehouse, past the outside cooking facilities, to the gift shop where the tour begins. My travel companions browsed the bookstore while I sat in the adjoined seating area, taking in the genealogy of enslaved persons who had formerly lived on the plantation. Someone had conveniently mounted photographs and biographies of these persons on the walls. There was Darius Bennett, a Somerset field hand who had heard the cannon signaling the Civil War. There was Betsy Spruill Riddick, seated with hands folded before a wooden shack. There was even a makeshift family tree dating back to the first enslaved Africans to arrive on Somerset Plantation. After a while, all of us there for the morning tour made our way into the seating area where our tour guide finally came in and stood before us. He wore khaki pants, a maroon polo shirt, and glasses. He was blonde-haired, blue-eyed, and stood about 6'3" tall. For the sake of discussion, I will refer to him as Mr. Swellfellow, because he had that look of a good hometown guy. He probably lived in the same neighborhood as his mother, if not with his mother, volunteered with the local fire department, and had a high school sweetheart he was engaged to. Went to church every Sunday, and as far as I could see, wore honesty about his face like a child wears a milky mustache. He was totally disarming and chubby and southern, and immediately attentive, standing before us, leaning on the mantle of the fireplace. After warming to us, he began by talking about the pictures on the wall and quickly segued into minor details about the plantation. Not all of the original buildings had been restored to the plantation. This was a walking tour that would begin at the overseer's quarters and end at the big house. A woman who had once tried to escape was put into the stocks in the winter time. Her legs froze, and they had to be amputated. Each month, enslaved adults received a ration of a peck of corn and 3 pounds of dried meat. "The slaves on this plantation were well fed," Mr. Swellfellow emphasized before rattling off more details about the tour. I tried to stay focused, but my mind returned to the rationed meat and cornmeal. The fact that hard field labor would have depleted such rations in a week, and the image of happy, well-fed darkies ever so casually introduced into Mr. Swellfellow's presentation. I raised my hand and waited for Mr. Swellfellow to call on me. True to his namesake, Mr. Swellfellow noticed my hand and welcomed my question. "Mr. Swellfellow," I began, "I want to go back to an earlier point you made for clarification. You said that the enslaved were given a peck of corn and 3 pounds of meat, and then you said that they were fed well. But to my thinking, the enslaved must have gone hungry, especially those working in the fields who would have needed more sustenance than this to sustain them in backbreaking, day-long labor." The smile on Mr. Swellfellow's face dimmed a little, even as he formulated an entirely hopeful response. "The slaves were fed well," he insisted. "It was not in the economic interest of the master to starve them, and besides, the Collinses were kind and had benevolent rations with their slaves." I raised my hand and waited for Mr. Swellfellow to call on me. True to his namesake, Mr. Swellfellow noticed my hand and welcomed my question. "Mr. Swellfellow," I began, "I want to go back to an earlier point you made for clarification. You said that the enslaved were given a peck of corn and 3 pounds of meat, and then you said that they were well fed. But to my thinking, the enslaved must have gone hungry, especially those working in the fields who would have needed more sustenance than this to sustain them in backbreaking, day-long labor." The smile on Mr. Swellfellow's face dimmed a little even as he formulated an entirely hopeful response. "The slaves were well fed," he insisted. "It was not in the economic interest of the master to starve them, and besides, the Collinses were kind and had benevolent relations with their slaves. They weren't the type to make their slaves go hungry." "Actually, Mr. Swellfellow," I interrupted, "it was in the economic interest of slave masters to starve their slaves. This fact is well documented in literature written by fugitive slaves. And on the subject of kindness, the so-called kindness of masters hardly ever, to my knowledge, interfered with their profit motive. What better way to profit than by giving your slaves minimal nourishment while you expect, in return for investment, maximum labor output? Only after I stopped speaking did I realize I was shaking internally and had taken an edge to my voice. I become aware of my African-American travel companion sitting across the room and the few other white tourists who were part of our morning party. Mr. Swellfellow had flushed and began to sweat. He had become anxious and nervous. Clearly, his National Park Service tour guide training had not prepared him to deal in a knowledgeable manner with questions of hunger and starvation on the plantation. Perhaps, too, he felt embarrassed at his immediately defensive posture, embarrassed at his rushing to defend the master, and, finally, embarrassed and angry at my daring to challenge what was clearly a sacred memory. Contented, well-fed blacks roaming about the plantation. Needless to say, this initial interaction with Mr. Swellfellow set the tone for the remainder of the tour. When, during the walking tour, he brought up the subject of enslaved persons stealing meat from the smokehouse, I responded by asking why such well-fed persons would have provocation to steal meat in the first place. At one point, thoroughly frustrated with the constant reinforcement of the pastoral and goodly nature of life on Somerset Plantation, I said to our tour guide so that everyone could hear, "Mr. Swellfellow, it seems to me that you and the state of North Carolina are invested in an image of the masters as goodly and that you are not willing to entertain perspectives of plantation life that go against this reality." Swellfellow, sweating even more profusely, denied my accusations and did his best to avoid me the remainder of the tour. The history of slavery continues to have meaning in the 20th century. It burdens all of American history and is incorporated into public interpretations of the past, write James Oliver Horton and Lewis E. Horton. We need look only as far as Somerset Place for an example of a historically laden and contested site of slavery memory. There, we see the circumstances of slave existence and the meaning of the master's authority and goodwill as fluid, contested categories of experience regulated by the state in a larger master narrative of slave history. Similar issues regarding the meaning and import of slavery have affected contemporary battlefields and Civil War sites operated by the National Park Service. As a result of pressure from Civil War heritage interest groups, those who give tours of these sites do not speak of slavery as the major social phenomenon that catalyzed the Civil War. In higher education, another state-regulated realm, the history of slave continues to shape our lives. A good example of this is Brown University. Brown, like a number of universities on the East Coast, has ties to slavery that trace back to its founder, John Brown. Members of Brown's educational community, who have attempted to reconcile the university's historic and economic ties with the institution of slavery, have, in the process, encountered staunch resistance from the regents and alumni, among other constituencies. From contemporary debates over national identity to concerns about modern civil rights, the legacy of slavery continues to inform and impact our sense of civic belonging and investment in the experiment called the United States. Living, as we do, in a society in which many still deny the fundamental tie between civil war and slavery helps me better understand, on a systemic level, Mr. Swellfellow's resistance to my insinuations of institutionalized hunger on the Somerset Plantation. An admission of institutionalized hunger on the plantation would have required Mr. Swellfellow to alter his notions of the goodly altruistic master. As well, such an allowance would have required that Mr. Swellfellow consider how sentimental conventions, Christian morals and values, Southern state formation and statecraft all informed our discussion of slaves made to hunger on the plantation. While Mr. Swellfellow had his own geographically bounded, he was from the surrounding area, and personal reasons for denying the existence of slave hunger, my insistence upon the topic arose mostly from the researching for and writing of this book. I had come to know, through my research, that instances of hunger within such a pristine, well-kept context were often only indicators of a much larger culture of institutionalized hunger. I had encountered numerous masters like Somerset's Josiah Collins III, who one biographer described as an autocrat with a will as imperious and a sway as absolute as the Tsar himself. Josiah III, I would find out months after my plantation tour, fit the profile of the cultivated, overlording type of master who used hunger and all manner of social conditioning to wring from enslaved people maximum labor and to instill in these persons fear and self-denial. Hunger, with persons such as Collins, was often only the tip of the iceberg. So much more than hunger was at stake in my interactions with Mr. Swellfellow. If he and I could not talk about hunger on the plantation, then we would never, as individuals or a nation, be able to talk about other intersecting issues, such as social consumption, ritualized hunger, or cannibalistic masters populating southern plantations such as Somerset Place. For my part, my encounters at Somerset Place disturbed me and catalyzed in me a state of personal and intellectual reflection. Was the nation, not to mention the state of North Carolina, ready for an open and inquiring discussion into the topics of hunger and human consumption on the plantation? Was I ready to and capable of serving as mediator of this discussion, which clearly had a life beyond the book pages I had labored to fill over the years? In the 19th century, none but the most radical abolitionists believed the enslaved person's claims about consuming masters and their descriptions of a culture of human consumption pervading plantation life. Over a century later, not much has changed. Not only had we collectively forgotten many of the significant details of slavery that continue to impact the present, but we had also willed ourselves to forget the horrific forms that human hunger and the pursuit of power could take. Despite our will to forget and desire to reconfigure the past, the reality is that institutionalized hunger and practices of human consumption characterized life on many southern plantations. No topic disturbed and mystified 19th century America like the subject of human consumption under slavery. For the most part, whites during the time responded to this topic, as did Mr. Swellfellow, with an air of secrecy and shame. For example, one of the most notorious incidents of literal black consumption from the 19th century involved members of the whaling ship Essex, which sailed from Nantucket, Massachusetts in 1838. While Nantucketers still today have little to say about the incident, especially the fact that the first four crew members to be murdered and eaten by whites were black, Nantucket was known in the 19th century as a Quaker and abolitionist stronghold, and its residents then and still today find it hard to explain ship captains operating as slave drivers. African persons treated in a brutish manner aboard whaling ships, and, more pointedly, the master-slave ideology informing the consumption of the four black men. Colonial-era Nantucketers were not alone in their self-preserving silence. Slave-owning whites, for different reasons, covered up the reality of black consumption. Take, for example, the circumstances surrounding the consumption of Nat Turner, the black insurrectionist. black members of the Southampton, Virginia community left oral records of whites who tried to coerce them into consuming Nat Turner's boiled down flesh and entrails. Black persons also implied that 19th century whites might have consumed the revolutionary as a medicinal substance. Whites from the time period dismissed such ideas as folk belief, arising from the backward and infantile culture of older darkies. To add to this, scholars of Turner's experience have, on the whole, denied, infantilized, or dismissed the observations of black persons. These scholars, it seems, are not aware of those aspects of U.S. plantation culture that were based in parasiticism and a dynamic of human consumption. In Slavery and Social Death, a comparative study, Orlando Patterson describes slavery as a parasitic institution that white masters strove to conceal in ideology and act. According to Patterson, the slaveholder, in order to maintain an image of himself as civilized and free of parasitic appetites, camouflaged his dependence, his parasiticism, by various ideological strategies. Paradoxically, he defined the slave as dependent. This is consistent with the human technique of camouflaging a relation by defining it as the opposite of what it really is. Parasite is the perfect concept for my purposes, as it implies a range of consumptive acts, some resulting in immediate death, but most involving the passage of time and the incremental feeding upon the human host. Most of my examples of consumption on and off the plantation range from the literal murder and eating of black persons to what we might think of as metaphoric acts. I refer to these metaphoric acts, which encompass starving, flesh-seasoning rituals, and sexual modes of consumption, variously as consumption, human consumption, metaphoric consumption, instances of social consumption, and even cannibalism. I will explain the historical and contemporary significance of such terms as cannibal later in the introduction. But I wanted to acknowledge here that I do use a range of terms to describe instances of consumption. My cluster of terms challenges the layers of stereotype and imprecise language that have historically characterized the topic of the consumption of slaves. As a common strategy, masters often hid their appetites and hungers in stereotypes and ideologies that attributed these characteristics to the slaves. Patterson describes a reality wherein the master deflected his appetites and hungers onto myths of the chattel slave as dependent, childlike, and somehow ennobled by the master's consumptive needs. In dismissing the bonded person's accusations of consumption as infantile rants, which I point out using Turner's example, scholars have reinforced the slave-owning, ruling class mentality and have helped to maintain a general code of silence regarding the master's appetites and sycophantic needs. This pattern of silencing has resulted in the dismissal of the reality of those enslaved persons who frequently describe slavery as an outgrowth of the master's homoerotic and consumptive appetites. Within U.S. slavery, black men and women consistently described incidents of human consumption that occurred on literal, metaphoric, and institutional levels of social interaction. These incidents often had a homoerotic or sexual charge to them. John S. Jacobs, for example, referred to his former masters as human fleshmongers, possessed of an unnatural hunger for human flesh and soul. Naked bodies depicted on the action block, instances of rape and sexualized torture coincide with the hunger and satiation described by Jacobs. For Solomon Northrup, the gastronomical enjoyments and excesses of whites included the sexualized treatment of men, such as himself, at the hands of slave catchers, overseers, and masters. Harriet Jacobs recorded in Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, written by herself, how white mistresses acted out hungers for and erotic desires for black women in intimate spaces on the plantation. Issues of sexual dominance and white male fixations on black male virility inform the consumption of Nat Turner. Acknowledging how scholars of U.S. and transatlantic slavery have largely ignored and dismissed accusations of the cannibalizing of black Americans, I take the enslaved person's claim of human consumption seriously, and I attempt throughout this project to draw attention to how blacks experience their consumption as fundamentally erotic and, more specifically, homoerotic occurrence. Given the taboo nature of homoeroticism in the 19th century, black people rarely wrote about same-sex experiences or encounters with whites. In the context of consumption, though, this topic was unavoidable. For blacks could not identify, name, and language and concept, negotiate, or resist the culture of human consumption they saw pervading plantation life without unearthing the erotic implications of their consumption and, even more, constructing a sexual politics that included homoeroticism. Amazingly, 19th century black Americans, without conscious forethought, created an entirely new language and symbolic system to describe not just their consumption, but also the deeper homoerotic nuances of black life under slavery. Linking this personal reality to the larger national political terrain, they developed strategies of resistance, a politics of moral accountability, and a social vision of human consumption that implicated the most cherished values and tenets of the Republic. When black Americans describe instances of the eating, cooking, and consumption of flesh in slave narratives, newspaper articles, speeches, testimonials, sermons, and autobiographies, they not only question the national body politic, but also try to understand why and how they had become so delectable, so erotically appetizing to a nation and white populace that, at least rhetorically, denied and despised their humanity. A New Orleans physician, Samuel A. Cartwright, perfectly captured this denial of and despising of the Negro in his medical writings. Cartwright's popular views depicted the Negro as childlike, lacking civilization, and therefore a completely undesirable species. On the topic of Negro infantile behavior, he writes, "Negroes, moreover, resemble children in the activity of the liver and in their strong assimilating powers, and in the predominance of the other systems over the sanguineous." Comparing the Negro's skin to that of an animal hide, he describes how his skin is very thick, and how he has a membrane called plissa lunaris, like that which observed in apes. He reserves his most sweeping comments for so-called African biological and racial inferiority, which, in his opinion, has rendered the people of Africa unable to take care of themselves. In reality, of course, enslaved black persons took care of whites, who often acted as sycophantic children in their demands, hungers, and insatiable needs. Under this cloud of delusion, wherein whites depicted the Negro as the helpless adult infant that they themselves embody, white hungers for and desires for the Negro could flourish. On the level of acquired taste for the Negro, Cartwright's pseudo-medical science portrays how myths of the Negro child, of the eroticized and animal-like African, stoked white appetites and made the Negro into a delectable, desirous object. Such references to black people as animal-like, infantile, and disfigured proliferate in pro-slavery rhetoric. They are so common that we do not naturally think of them as indexes of desire, of white people's fixations upon and obsessions with black bodies and sex. Even more, we are not in the habit of reading homoeroticism into comments made by persons such as Cartwright. Within the culture of consumption, there existed numerous examples of homoerotic affection between black and white men, sexualized violence, and incest bonds, among other phenomena. Yet such affections were often veiled or hidden within rhetorics of objectification and abjection. For white men, sex with and sexual attraction to black men was a natural byproduct of their physical, emotional, and spiritual hunger for the same. For black men, on the other hand, homoeroticism was a means of resisting, accommodating, and transforming the discourse of black consumption. For example, in the process of speaking about their sexual consumption, black men crossed gender boundaries, adopted the genders and identities of black and white women, and imagined themselves giving birth to new archetypes of the nation. Within black nationalist movements dating from slavery to the 1960s, black men linked effeminacy and homosexuality with the white desire to culturally and spiritually consume black men. Even black women in the late 20th century link their discussions of mother hunger and self-consumption during slavery with violent acts of homoeroticism, references to male rape and oral violation. While the culture of U.S. consumption frames my narrative, this is a book as much about homoeroticism as it is about flesh consumption. The multiple desires African-American men and women successfully resisted their consumption and constructed a racial politics based on the hunger and desire to recover self and collective. Transatlantic Origins of Black Consumption. The origins of the U.S. culture of consumption trace back to the first contact between colonizers and coastal Africans. By the early 20th century, even Europeans admitted to and documented a connection between European global expansion and a sexual libidinal appetite for African flesh. A cartoon published in the French journal L'Œil in 1911 demonstrates how European hungers for conquest sometimes coincided with a homosexual hunger for African flesh. In the foreground of the cartoon, a porter, soldier, and general gather around a Bakongo man stabbed into a skewer. The Bakongo man spins around and awaits the slice of the butcher's knife resting at his knees. A 1937 cartoon published in the Belgian magazine Honger Leven that also depicted Europeans' cannibalism had a caption that perfectly captured the irony of an African turning on a skewer. Any takers for Negro soup? Such cartoons depict a different species of cannibal and an altogether different master narrative of cannibalism informing European expansion into Africa. The word Congo is tattooed on the African man's loincloth, establishing a connection between the carving up of Africa by numerous European nations and the carving up of the African male body. The homoerotic bonds shared among the white men gathered around the African man highlight the promise of Negro soup, with the Bakongo, Congo, man serving as a symbol of their common purpose and desire. The African body is spread-eagled before this tableau of male bonding. The general and his captain of arms, who turns a skewer, look across the black man's body into one another's eyes. The other men, bent over the half-naked body, appear to be captivated by their vulnerable prey turning delectably on the skewer. One soldier has his hand on his hips. The other has his palms pressed together and tucked tightly into his groin. The knife in the general's hand resembles a phallus, thick on the bottom and a narrower at the tip. With his phallus in one hand, the general squats between the African man's legs, holding his calves apart. The Bakongo man is positioned in a manner that provides for easy anal access, the missionary position. In the Belgian cartoon, sexual, erotic tastes are indistinguishable from the palate. The knife and the phallus are interchangeable signifiers. This cartoon depicts a widespread belief in Western and Central Africa that Europeans were cannibals. Groups such as the Igbo, Bakongo, Fanti, and Guinea all thought of European interlopers as cannibals. A century earlier, for example, Ali Esemani of the Borno people in Nigeria described his encounter with a European cannibal in a manner laden with terror and homoeroticism. A Sami is transported a slave throughout many Western African regions. Slave traders finally bring him and a group of kinsmen to the home of a white minister in Bathurst in 1818. The minister comes out of his home and surveys all of the slaves. He takes a marked interest in a Sami, who recalls the man took hold of my hand and drew me into his house. According to Esami and the other Africans assembled, the white man strongly desires him, takes a delectable interest in this Bornu man. The terrors and observations of the other enslaved African persons erupt into whispered rumor. The white man has taken Ali and put him into the house in order to slaughter him. Inside the house, Ali imagines his seducer wielding a phallic object, a long knife. If this white man takes a knife, he thinks to himself, and I see it in his hand, I will hold it. The threat of sexual domination and dismemberment hovers at the edges of Isami's imagination. The Africans translate white male phallic power over the effeminized African subject into an erotics of appetite and eating. The slave trade ferried this culture of homoeroticism and consumption aboard slave ships across the Atlantic, where it took root and assumed a number of new forms in the context of chattel slavery. For example, within plantation culture, this culture of consumption took the form of whites literally flaying and smoking African-American flesh and overt references in slave narratives to masters literally and metaphorically consuming their slaves. For the slave, this culture of consumption was a fact of daily life, as was amply documented in slave narratives, Works Progress Administration, WPA interviews of ex-slaves, letters, political treatises, and autobiographies from the antebellum period. A Belgian cartoon, Ali Esami and the literal and metaphorical consumption documented in slave narrative, letters, WPA interviews, and autobiographies are each examples of a horrific dimension of African-American experience that is difficult, if not almost impossible, to put into language. Toni Morrison referred to this region of African-American experience as the unspeakable. In her writing about 19th century literature and slave culture, she makes subtle references to a white culture of consumption. In an example from Playing in the Dark, Whiteness and the Literary Imagination, Morrison describes whites, and in particular a white slave mistress, as gathering identity unto herself from the wholly available and serviceable lives of Africanist others. Morrison describes a social and emotional form of cannibalism, or parasiticism, taking place in the context of plantation culture. This subject of cannibalism so disturbed the white educated female audience of Harriet Jacobs' slave narrative that she moved all references to flesh cooking, flesh carving, and eating in her slave narrative to one chapter that readers could conveniently skip. Many morally conscious whites registered the disturbing implications of cannibalism and sought to address its national implications. For example, in Herman Melville's Moby Dick, or The Whale, which the author based upon incidents of consumption of black males at sea, Ishmael draws a parallel between his cannibal shipmate and George Washington, the first president of the United States. Queequeg, says Ishmael about his companion, was George Washington's cannibalistically developed. It is possible that our beloved slave-owning first president and founding father, George Washington, embodied cannibalistic hungers? This question, posed to a fictional character, struck at the heart of American founding mythologies, national issues of hunger and taste, genteel posturing, and ideals of a pure white paternity. For African Americans, this question was much more personal and poignant. Most slave narratives contain overt or covert references to flesh eating. In his Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, an American Slave, Frederick Douglass described the entire institution of slavery as a towering cannibal being. There stood slavery, glaring frightfully upon us, its robes already crimson with the blood of millions, and even now feasting itself greedily upon our own flesh. Most of what Douglass knew and felt, though, about his institutionalized cannibalism remains unspeakable and undocumented. "I wish," he says, "I wish I could commit to paper the feelings with which I beheld it." In part, the subject of cannibalism has been unspeakable for black men because of the homoerotic implications of such experiences. Kara Walker, commenting upon European and white cannibalism, has observed that there is a little bit of masochism, so much love and hate involved in eating something, to kill something and eat it. It's very sexual, very sensual. The consumption of black flesh often took place in the context of incestuous plantation dynamics. A master would often choose a favorite male slave as the object of his cultivated delight. Black men in such contexts had to negotiate feelings of affection, hatred, shame, sexual degradation, and arousal toward white men. Cannibalism was unspeakable, but cannibalism coupled with the subject of homoeroticism went against conventional ideas of black men as stoic, as embodiments of the valiant struggle of will and mind over body, as agents of reason and political strategy. To speak about the feelings associated with his own flesh consumption would have aligned Douglass too deeply with the unspeakable knowledge of the body as sexual and sensual object, potentially undermining the literary and literate authority we have come to associate with his masculinity. Long before the poignant questions of the color line and the Negro problem registered in the black imagination, it seems that a more pressing problematic confronted the black citizen. In the form of a question, it might have been registered as, "How does it feel to be an edible, consumed object?" In other words, how does it feel to be an energy source and foodstuff, to be consumed on the levels of body, sex, psyche, and soul? Answers to such questions had personal and national implications, as the personal plight of the Negro formed part of a larger homoerotic master narrative of colonial conquest and male desire. For the Negro as well as the white person, such questions necessitated a reconsideration of basic American values, such as gentility and social etiquette, colonial drive and hunger, and cherished racial categorizations. Linking homoeroticism to cannibalism. My study emphasizes homoeroticism over homosexuality. By definition, homoeroticism implies same-sex arousal and draws attention to those political, social, and libidinal forces that shape desire and, ultimately, the homosexual act. The homosexual components of the feasting, partaking of the boiling pot of Negro soup, are less important to me than the radical assumptions, political aspirations, gender codes, philosophical frameworks, and cosmologies that dictated the feelings of arousal on the part of European and white Americans towards black males and hunger for black male flesh. For example, the larger discussion of Negro effeminacy or the idea of the Negro as the lady of the races, shapes European male desire in the Belgian cartoon. It sets the stage for homosexual consumption and makes possible what Eve Sedgwick refers to as homosocial bonding. Sedgwick has written about Victorian-era homosocial desire as operating through triangulation, operating through its relation to women and the gender system as a whole. Her referent for gender is the female body. However, in the cartoons discussed above, the African man functions as the feminized figure, through him, the general, the soldiers, the porters, and the field attendants bond and share in homoerotic desire. The final outcome of the Negro soup scene is a type of homosexual consumption. However, long before we get to the homosexual act, the machinery of homoeroticism clicks into play, shaping and dictating the meaning and significance of the homosexual act. David Halperin has cautioned against easy conflations of modern conceptions of sexual subjectivity with those that figured in the emotional lives of pre-modern subjects. His concerns reflect the general understanding within queer theory of homosexuality as a constructed historical phenomenon. Medical and physiological discourses at the turn of the 20th century normalized and pathologized the homosexual personality type. The word homosexual was, in turn, reclaimed by the same-sex identified activists, intellectuals, and cultural workers in the 1950s and 1960s. However, the word homosexual had no currency in the 18th and 19th centuries. Neither, for that matter, did the word homoeroticism. Taking to heart the importance and necessity of historical specificity, I do not attempt to homoeroticize Black experience in the 19th century. That is, I do not attempt to graft an arbitrary language and sexual modality onto the time period. The word homoeroticism in my study serves as a referent for the large set of same-sex desires and intimacies that include romantic friendship between men, same-sex incest in the context of plantation patriarchy, the romanticization of and exotization of whiteness, and literal and metaphoric cannibalism, among other things. All of these terms I identify and extrapolate from their appropriate historical and cultural contexts. Often, though, when a blanket term is called for, I use the word homoeroticism to refer to any combination of these subcategories of experience. By coupling homoeroticism with cannibalism, I have sought to ground the meaning of the word cannibalism in the African-European encounter in the Middle Passage, the originary site of Black erotic sexual encounter. Paul Gilroy's The Black Atlantic, Modernity and Double Consciousness, resuscitates the Atlantic as a living symbolic and cultural entity for Black people of the African diaspora. Gilroy effectively recast the Atlantic as a 20th century migratory structure through the image of ships, composed of triangular routes along with Black people in South Africa, England, and the Americas have ferried philosophical, political, and musical materials. Like Gilroy, I also appeal to the African diaspora as a site of Black cultural formation and transmission. However, for me, the organizing metaphor is not the ship, but the captured bodies brought aboard slave ships and the ways those bodies, specifically male bodies, underwent process of sexual and social cannibalization. Traditionally, historical considerations of cannibalism in the context of European exploration and occupation of foreign lands focus on European ideas of natives, American and African, as cannibals. Take the 1503 decree of Queen Isabella of Spain that dictated that no Indians under her dominion were to be hurt or captured. However, a certain people called cannibals might be fairly fought and, if captured, enslaved as punishment for crimes committed against my subjects. This early distinction between Indians and cannibals would eventually give way to the thought that all Indians and Indian ways were heathen were subject to cannibalistic practices. Similarly, Europeans, generally speaking, believed diverse African groups from one end of the continent to the other a cannibalistic race. 19th century Europeans and Americans promulgated the idea of the heathen African, which also implied cannibalism. Speaking of the Christian Reformation of the African cannibal, Reverend Henry Ward Beecher defined heathenism in 1850 as derived from idolatry, from fornication and incest, from infanticide and cannibalism. Today, a growing body of cannibalism scholarship has developed that spans the disciplines of literature, anthropology, history, philosophy, political economy, cultural studies, and post-colonial studies. In fact, cannibalism is said by many scholars to be one of the most important topics in cultural criticism today. An exciting outcome of this emerging corpus of cannibalism scholarship is that it takes us beyond the Eurocentric master narrative of cannibalism into a complex arena that includes, for example, recent sophisticated work on African Main and Azunde customs and practices of cannibalism. We now have a deeper understanding of the human sacrifice and consumption rituals of Aztec and other Mesoamerican people. We also now have studies that excavate and analyze European legacies of religious, medicinal, and survival cannibalism, and still other studies that locate the cannibalistic urge within the European Enlightenment itself, within the workings of the modern and postmodern European and American state. The postcolonial branch of contemporary cannibalism studies has been most helpful to my work. This branch has, more than any other, undertaken to unearth and analyze the cannibalism discourses that arose from colonial contact between Europeans and Africans and Native Americans. As I emphasized earlier, Europeans were not the only ones who understood the colonial encounter in terms of cannibalism. On both sides of the Atlantic, in Africa and the Americas, Black and African people in the 19th century documented this culture in slave and travel narratives, political philosophy, and treatises, newspaper articles and sermons, among other types of documentation. For example, the famous 1839 slave insurrection aboard the ship Amistad occurred because the Mende revolt leader, Segbe Pie, and those who followed him feared that Spanish slavers intended to eat them. As I have demonstrated, the African belief that Europeans were cannibals was not uncommon. Importantly, such beliefs represented the captured Africans' first articulations of an intersection between themselves, their bodies, erotic life force, labor capacity, and exoticization, and the Europeans' hunger for new land, physical, and psychic contact with foreign others, and a perfect state of global dominion. The logic and incisiveness of those first African critiques of European cannibalism have accrued power and congealed into a number of contemporary African cannibal discourses. For example, in contemporary Sierra Leone, the land of those original Mende aboard the Amistad, cannibalism serves as a politically charged hidden transcript intended to expose, discredit, and disrupt the imbricated relations of power at work in Sierra Leone during the late 1980s, just prior to its descent into civil war. Today, in the context of post-colonial African political struggles, the language of inequality continues to revolve around the metaphors of eating and, by extension, cannibalistic consumption. The troop of cannibalism as a symbol for the economic exploitation, material accumulation, and violent coercion carried out by post-colonial elites has, in fact, come to dominate Africa political discourse. Because the examples of cannibalism that I use in the book range from figurative troops to literal flesh-eating to rituals of flesh-taking and harvesting, I employ a cluster of terms that delineate the range of applications and cannibalism context that my study encompasses. The list includes the word consume, consumption, social consumption, appetite, taste, delectable, delectability, hunger, ingestion, and auto-cannibalism. I use the words cannibalism and consumption interchangeably. The phrase a culture of consumption might elsewhere appear as a cannibal culture. I frequently use consumption as a modifier, as in consumption rituals and consumption practices. I think that my preference for the word consumption has something to do with the word's rootedness in modern notions of market economies, commodities, consumer appetite, and so forth. While my usage is always particular and usually grounded in human-to-human exchanges, I always have in mind the affluent ruling class 18th and 19th century economies that make possible the consumption of the slave along with other traded commodities, such as liquor, spices, and foodstuffs from foreign lands. I use the words taste, appetite, and delectable mostly to refer to how the desire for the African slave or American black person had Epicurean implications. This desire was less about literal consumption and more about the cultivated taste the white person developed for the African. Whites often satiated this taste and appetite through acts of violence, sexual exploitation, imagined ingestion of the black, or through stage rituals designed to incrementally harvest black spirit and soul. The delectability of the black person was of course a factor in literal flesh consumption. But my main point, which I explain at length in Chapter 1, is that literal cannibalism always occurred within cultural, ideological contexts. The cultural context to which I frequently refer, the plantation, the slave ship, the general schooner, the African coastal town, were highly eroticized situations and locales. The words delectable, taste, and appetite bring together homoeroticism in these contexts with overlapping occurrences of consumption. My use of the word hunger relates to the idea of auto-cannibalism. Auto-cannibalism, or self-consumption, involves people consuming themselves voluntarily or through external coercion. In many instances, the cultivation of literal and emotional hunger in the slave produced the opposite effect. The hunger for familial connection, for self and safety, and the ability to resist literal and spiritual consumption led to just that, resistance and self-reclamation in the slave. In the second part of the book, chapters 5 and 6, this idea of hunger takes prominence, as I delineate the numerous ways the slave resisted cannibalism and struggled mightily against the institutionalized urge for self-consumption. The emphasis upon the economic and metastructural in contemporary cannibalism discourse, especially within the post-colonial branch, has tended to obscure the underlying erotic implications of cannibalism between Europeans and Africans. This body of belief in political philosophy tends to evade or stop short of addressing issues of sexuality, sexual power, desire, and same-sex eroticism. I foreground same-sex eroticism because it brings the focus to issues of desire, power, and gender formation, and helps me establish cannibalism as an originary framework for the emergence of homoeroticism out of the transatlantic slave trade and plantation culture. At the juncture where homoeroticism and cannibalism intersected, a new type of cannibalism system, beliefs and practices, emerged. On the continent of Africa, encounters with white Christian minister cannibals expanded traditional Western and Central African cannibal beliefs to include the church, mercantilism, and European imperialism as institutionalized venues of cannibalism and resource consumption. In the U.S. South, the complexity and newness of the cannibal system registered in legal and religious discussion about Christian cannibalism, and an existent cannibal jurisdiction within southern legislative and geographic territories.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. We just heard the first audio segment. Vincent Woodard, the Delectable Negro. Again, hat tip, much gratitude for Dr. Tommy J. Curry. He's been a guest on the program numerous times. He is the person who first mentioned Delectable Negro and encouraged us to check it out. He's mentioned a myriad of books. We've had a lot of different guests of authors, authors that he's recommended over the years. But this, wow. Wow. Right on for Dr. Curry. Okay. Number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. You can use the free VOPE line if you don't want to use your phone to dial in. It's linked at Black Talk Radio Network. The address, tiny.cc/oneRace. And that is the number one. The address again, tiny.cc/oneRace. And that is the number one. Once you put in the address, click the link on the left of the page. It says free VOPE dialer. When you do so, it will open a small window on your screen. Top line, it is a drop-down menu. Select the number that I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. Next line, it will ask for the code. That code again is 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can use your real name, nickname. If you're comfortable with all that, you can just press random keys. Whatever you choose, once you get all that information entered, click the green button. It will connect you to the live program. All you have to do from that point, same procedure. You'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 6. You'll hear the audio prompt. Press the number 1, and I'll see your hand. We will get you on the line. Wowie, quite a transition from the breakthrough, Gwen Ifill, the late Gwen Ifill, finished her text up last week. Folks have commentary they would like to share, and we're only in the introduction. We haven't even finished the introduction of the text, reminding me a lot of Harriet Washington, the great Harriet Washington's medical apartheid. I think it took us a whole week just to get through the introduction to the book. Fascinating on so many accounts. My internet signal went out for a moment, but I think it's back. We're connected. The live stream should be back. If you're listening on live, just refresh. If you're at TuneIn or Black Talk Radio Network or wherever online, if you dialed in by phone, then shouldn't be a problem. But hopefully we won't have any more disturbances. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Feel free to share.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Greetings, Gus, and callers and listeners on the line. This is Rob in Milwaukee, and I'm still growing. A few observations. Great book. I looked for the book in my local library, college library. They didn't have it. And the surprisingly, the black female in my attempted survival unit ordered the book for me, which should be arriving in a couple of days. And observations.
Black love, a little black self-respect for your attempted partner. Right on, right on.
Thank you, thank you. some of the text I felt went over my head a little bit because I don't have the text right here. I wasn't able to follow along. So my notes is pretty spotty. So just bear with me. I took note that the Somerset Plantation was in North Carolina. Shout out to Mr. Scotty Reed. And said that when the guy was on the tour, when he asked the white person about the slaves being well fed, and when he challenged the white guy, the white guy became defensive of the slave master, and I recognized that as regular white behavior. The part about the abolitionists were the ones that were reporting the cannibalism. Nobody else really wanted to believe that. Another shout out to Mr. Scotty Reed. It's like today you know, tell people that things really haven't changed or that slavery still exists. They'd be like, wow, what are you talking about? We got Obama and LeBron and, you know, everybody else. Mr. Cartwright, I think that was the, I just remember the name. I don't remember exactly who he was, but some of the things that he was stating about black people, I want to say he was an author or a doctor, but he said that black people had assimilating powers. That really stood out. And talked about their thick skin comparable to apes and unable to take care of themselves. Seemed like the narrative is pretty much still the same. Not a lot has changed. The Negro suit that stood out. I know we just had a black female. I think she was in Belgium. If I'm not right, correct me, Gus. And that stood out about the cartoon that was in the book, like in the early 1900s, connected to cannibalism. And the black female that was on the program had mentioned she didn't hear anything about King Leopold or what the Congo had been through until she reached high school. So that stood out. And the secrecy and shame that they said that the white people feel about their cannibalism, I think that directly ties to the albinism as well. And I'll mute my line for now. Thanks for listening and taking the call. And thank you.
For sure.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir. Thomas in New York.
Good evening, guys. Good evening, Rob, all the rest of the callers. You're right, quite a transition. Oh, man. You know, the system of racism and white supremacy, it's not going to end until there's no more white people, because their culture is anti-life, and I'm glad this book is like a blind indictment on just one of the mere minuscule aspects of their nature, cannibalism. I'm going to add this in with pedophilia and homosexuality as parts of white culture. The Belgium, I mean, my gosh, I mean, even with the sexually suggestive, cannibalistic newspaper, it seemed like he was describing clips from magazines and things. Just totally disgusting. And don't even care to put it out there, like, hey, this is what we do. They're just a little bit more discreet with it now, but I guarantee this is going on. It's just white culture. I think this book is definitely going to heat up. and I hope it does. I just can't. And the funny thing is, not too long ago, I was watching one of those lockup shows, and they were in Russia, and the number one crime people were in there for was cannibalism. You know, people eating their neighbors and stuff, and it's like they're still doing this, but I'm sure they love black dark meat. It's probably greasier or something to them. I don't know. I'll get my line on that. Thank you very much, guys.
Can I be heard?
Yes.
Can I be heard?
Go ahead, sis. I'll go after you.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am. We can hear you.
Hey, I just want to make a little observation that I think that, like, no matter where you are and you're looking at a system of racism, white supremacy, the elite white people have always practiced, like, cannibalism and pedophilia and all types of things against black people. And I'm not sure if it's some kind of ritual or anything like that, but I think it's like no matter where you look at in any point in time, from slavery all up through Sandusky, it's always some type of elite, rich white people harming black bodies with sex and cannibalism. And I mute my line on that.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir, Roz.
Greetings to you, Gus, to all the other callers and listeners. You have no idea how excited I am about this book. When I first read it, and big up, super big up to Dr. Tommy Curry. That brother is incredible. I love him. And this book was just one of the greatest gifts he gave to me as far as reading. And I just felt it was so important for us to collectively read the book, and especially from a counter-racist perspective. So prepare yourself, folks. It's going to be a really good one. Might be hard to stomach some of it, but it's totally worth it. To get to the text itself, he writes on page 6, Colonial era Nantucketers, were not alone in their self-preserving silence. Slave-owning whites, for different reasons, covered up the reality of black consumption. Take, for example, the circumstances surrounding the consumption of Nat Turner, the black insurrectionist. Black members of Southampton, Virginia community, of the Southampton, Virginia community, oral records of whites who tried to coerce them into consuming Nat Turner's boiled down flesh and entrails. Black persons who implied that 19th century whites might have consumed the revolutionary as a medicinal substance. Whites from the time period dismissed such ideas as folk belief arising from the backward and infantile culture of older darkies, in quotes. To add to this, scholars of Turner's experience have, on whole, denied, infantilized, or dismissed the observations of black persons.
Man.
And what I find interesting about this is that we have the same thing happening today where black people are not believed for anything that we say. Nothing we say is taken seriously. And even though it's documented evidence there, stuff is happening, captured on camera, you're still not believed. It reminds me of Rosa Parks, and when you discussed Gus earlier in her life when she did domestic work in white people's houses, about the wholesale rape that was taking place down south with black women, and that they couldn't even go to the police and report rape. It was literally like non-existence of black women going to report it because they had no power to get anything done about it. So this is just a culture of keeping black people silent, and in our silence, we allow them to perpetuate the same misdeeds on subsequent generations. So it's so important for us to talk about what's happening to us, even though it can be very traumatizing to have to psychologically relive some of the things these white people do to us. That's why I love workplace racism. Thank you for that. On the following page, he writes, "My cluster of terms challenges the layers of stereotype and imprecise language that have historically characterized the topic of the consumption of slaves. As a common strategy, masters often hid their appetites and hungers in stereotypes and ideologies attributed these characteristics to the slaves. Patterson describes a reality wherein the master deflects his appetites and hungers onto myths of the chattel slave as dependent, childlike, and somehow ennobled by the master's consumptive needs. In dismissing the bounded persons accusations of consumption as infantile rants, which I point out using Turner's example. Scholars have reinforced this slave-owning, ruling-class mentality have helped to maintain a general code of silence regarding the master's appetites and sycophantic needs. Now, this is very, very important to me, because when you look at the entire system of white supremacy, is also a major thing is deception in the form of projection. So essentially, like he's saying here, everything that the white people placing on the slaves, as far as black people being cannibals, black people being black males being the effeminate race, I guess, all of those things are things that are inherent in white culture. And it's just interesting because even today, it's the same practices again. They're still projecting their behaviors onto us. And systemically, globally speaking, we are the demonized group of all other groups because of the darkest. So it's really something to look at, just the patterns of behavior and how they continue to survive. And sometimes just by our mere silence, we actually give more power to it because we're not forming our children and subsequent generations about what to expect from these people in order to fight the system of white supremacy. At the bottom of the page, he writes, given the taboo nature of homoeroticism in the 19th century, black people rarely wrote about same-sex experiences or encounters with whites. In the context of consumption, though, this topic was unavoidable, for blacks could not identify, name in language and concept, negotiate, or resist the culture of human consumption they saw pervading plantation life without unearthing the erotic implications of their consumption. And even more, constructing a sexual politics that included homoeroticism. Amazingly, 19th century black Americans, without conscious forethought, created an entirely new language and symbolic system to describe not just their consumption, but also the deeper homoerotic nuances of black life under slavery. And what I find interesting about that is that they speak about the taboo nature of homosexuality and homoeroticism. And, of course, for black people, it's not something that we would discuss, especially in the early 19th century. Juxtapose that to today, where they're teaching little children in elementary school about all kinds of LGBTQ, all kinds of rogue sexual behavior. And to put it in context, stuff like this being discussed today would be so normal. And now, because a lot of us have been chemically altered and abused into participating in anti-sexual behavior, ultimately this is stuff that has become acceptable. So think about that. Back then it was taboo. Today it's every day. Now you have little children coming home telling their parents that they want a sex change at 5 or 6 years old. And lastly, I just wanted to speak on the cartoons. If you get the book, the cartoons are very interesting. And what I find very telling about it is exactly how he described the homoerotic nature of the white men surrounding the black men that they're about to cut up. And also the round table of white men, including Hitler, that have black people's bodies in dished out as soup. It just says that when white people collectively get together, all they think about is consuming black people. And that is why we have a lot of the experiences we have at the job and in our daily reality dealing with whites. All of it is a form of consumption. Even the murders of our people on camera, when you see it happening, they're consuming that by making it the new postcard, modern day postcards of lynchings. Thank you. And I'll mute my line.
Can I be heard?
May I be heard?
Let's get the female caller first.
Hello, this is Jay from Ohio. I just wanted to say I feel like when I went back in the archives and I listened to medical apartheid, I feel like it keeps coming up almost every time that I look around or even like we do some type of book study or what have you. But it just definitely makes me think about, especially in the part where they were talking about this, where the author was talking about the as far as some white physician saying that we have thicker skin, and that just goes back to medical apartheid. It is definitely one of the best books I've ever heard of. When the author was talking about just the consumption, and I used to read a lot about serial killers, especially Jeffrey Dahmer, it definitely puts it into a lot of context as far as why he he enjoyed like melanated men so much, especially most of his victims being black men. And then also reading about another serial killer in Europe after or around World War One, where he would take children, take vagrants, and he had like a butcher shop, and he would sell the meat to people. And when other white people, they thought it was suspicious about all this meat, someone else would tell them, "Well, you should be happy that you're getting meat at all." But it definitely helps to better understand the whole cannibalism as far as the actual ingesting of humans. And that's basically all also one other thing. It also made me think about on one episode, you were talking about how Dr. Frances Cress Welding, she was looking in a newspaper, and maybe it was a poster board or something like that, where they're talking about organ donations, and it had a picture of a black male, and it said, "Well, we need so many eyes and the arrow to the eyes and what have you." And that's also it also helped me to better understand that, as far as it's not just physical consumption, like the author was saying, but it is consumption in so many different ways. That's all I have for now. Thank you for listening.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, greetings, Gus, and greetings to the callers and listeners. This book is pretty interesting if you can stomach it, but, you know, it's lots of information so far. The introduction where the author met this Mr. Swellfellow, he calls him, you know, white people always like to downplay the atrocities of slavery. It's funny, you know, like my father used to tell me about, you know, white people he used to argue with about, you know, slavery wasn't all that bad, and he looked at them all crazy, like, "Are you kidding me?" And, you know, what's also interesting is in my family lineage, and you talked about North Carolina, we trace our lineage back to North Carolina as well. And, you know, it kind of like gives me flashbacks, because we have documented narratives of my great-great-grandfather who talked about slavery during his time. So that was kind of reminded me of that. When it talked about the Nat Turner, when Nat Turner was chopped up and eaten by the white people, I went back to the Birth of a Nation movie that came out last year, and they talked about how his skin was used for oil. And I thought that was interesting because, you know, I guess that was their kind way of letting them know what whites, you know, what whites did to Nat Turner, and leaving out the part of them eating Nat Turner. So, you know, it's so funny, you know, white people started cannibalism, but, you know, they don't want to admit that, and how much it is ingrained in their culture. The term, one of the paragraphs that he used in regards to the terminology of how he uses cannibalism and delectable and all the other terms, I wish he would have used that in the beginning of the book, you know, so I can, because it kind of like confused me for a little bit, some of the terminology he was using. But he did, he did clear it up in that paragraph. I just wish the placement of it was in the beginning, just like kind of like literary suggestions. And, you know, overall, you know, the sexualization, you know, the misuse of sexualization and rape and, you know, this is all ingrained in white European cultures, going back to the Roman times all the way up to, you know, now, you know. I specifically remember there was a guy in France who wrote a book, a guy named Marquis de Sade. He was actually a French politician who wrote a book called The 120 Days of Sodom. And it talks about these wealthy white males who would capture like these, you know, young males and females and basically take them up to the mountains and torture them sexually, and and do all kind of crazy things to them and then kill them in the end. And it was so, you know, the thing was that what would prompt a guy to write a book like that? And what was so crazy about it was the book was banned, but then it was republished in the early 20th century. So, you know, in mostly European countries as well. So this is their culture here. And, you know, I'm still trying to find out when we as African people became the cannibals, when it was all along they were the cannibals. So this book is kind of clearing this up, and hopefully it'll even, you know, clarify it even more. Thank you, and I'll meet my line.
Any callers we have not heard from at all?
Yes, Nick?
Yes, sir.
Yes, greetings. Gus, greetings to the rest of the callers. I'm very much enjoying this read. I think it's, wow, it's very challenging. Not because it's hard to hear what's going on. It's just it's making me think too much. I enjoy how Vincent Woodard creates the context for all of the homoerotic behavior and what they're doing, about what it meant in the 18th and 19th century, even going far as back, as the previous caller was saying, you know, from contact, when these people came into contact with Africans, this was a theme. And we can continually see it today. I'm very interested on how he is going to show the development of the relationship throughout, hopefully to modern times. The instance with the plantation owner at the very beginning, or the worker, I guess the park service at the plantation at the beginning, to me was very touching. White people tend to be very reserved and incredulous. They don't believe that this would happen. It almost feels as if you're attacking them to bring this up. And I felt that was what the worker felt whenever Vincent approached him and tried to get that information out of him, following sound logic as well, but they're not really having it. The interviews from the Works Progress Administration, I'd never heard of that group before, and I believe they were, you know, post-Civil War group. I have to do some more research on them, but they seem to be a source of information that he used, and I wanted to do more research on that. But there's just so much information about white culture and African culture that it's just pouring out the seams. I happen to relate to some of the cultural references because my parents are from Sierra Leone. So when I hear some of the names, they're very familiar, as well as some of the just beliefs as far as white people, because my father, up until the mid-1950s, he was shocked when he told me he saw his first white person when he was about 7 or 8. So it's bringing back those ideas and stories that my father told me about the first time he saw a white person, because they were really scarce in the part of the world he was in at that time in Sierra Leone. So I'm enjoying the read very much, and I hope that everyone else is. I'll take my call offline. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, everybody. I'm very excited that we are reading The Delectable Negro for many, many reasons. And so far, I am even more excited than I was when I got the book. I didn't even touch it, just so it could be all new when I got here. And even just the beginning part of the introduction is jam-packed with so much information that I'm so grateful for the text. Also, thank you for the person narrating it so that we could read it. I'm grateful for that as well. There's a lot that I would like to try to talk about, but I want to be as concise as possible. And one thing that stuck out to me in reading some of the things that the Black people were saying about the white person is that these white people are what I'm thinking these are what we would call, or what I would call, quote unquote, gentlemen. And these are very refined white people, not, and I think maybe another female caller might have said, like, rich white people. And we'll just have to, like, this is, like, I don't think I'm going to use gentlemen anymore, because I think in the same way they have that, like, velvet glove, that finesse, that selecting from one of the Negroes, that palate or that taste or that desire for consumption, and they would be gay. And so that term, I think, is just going to be no more in my vocabulary. And I am certain, almost certain, that this author is going to talk about homosexual conditioning. I put those two together because I think one of the reasons I'm so excited for the text is that I've noticed, as many, many other people have, the exponential increase of homosexual behavior in the non-white, specifically Black community, between females, but especially noticeably between the males, and a very heightened sense of identity / gender confusion. And I think the text will help to illuminate why that is. Like, it's one thing to be able to say, well, it's because of slavery and oppression and the emasculation of Black men, but it's another to have documented instances that to be able to cite and to say this is how it happened, through our being consumed and Black males being consumed specifically in the text, which is, I do think that is specifically different than Black female consumption. And it's putting that in the same kind of pool right next to Dr. Welsing's work. She talks a lot about Black male consumption. She doesn't use it in that way that I have heard her in the times that I have. But that's essentially what she's talking about. And so there's something very, especially if the white male is like homosexual by nature, which I think so. Like, that's kind of where I'm leaning now. I could be incorrect. Then his fixation really would be on Black men. And it is on Black men, evidenced in so much. I mean, even the gun could be put into context, because if you're consuming, it's the eroticizing of, like, absolute energy expansion. When you expend energy. And so on page 14, how does it feel to be an edible consumed object? Thought that was like, man, I really don't know. You know what I'm saying? Scary, honestly, you know, because I know it at some level when I listen to the other text, the guy that wrote Vampires, Cannibals, and something else, but he's white, so he didn't really want to look at it the way that this book is about to examine that very notion that white people are vampires and we are their source of energy. And no matter what, like, I was even thinking about so-called entertainment. So much of what we do is just feeding white people in whatever way they get fed, whether it's off of viewing our bodies in any type of hypersexualized fashion, watching sports, which involves a lot of, or male sports in particular, a lot of men being in very close contact. And then these are very, muscular sports, so-called masculine men bumping into each other and doing all that kind of thing. Football, which is like the most violent of them, like it's all over, whether it's the music videos, like everything that we do is like white people are getting our energy from it, even at the work, like walking out your house and you're just next to a white person, there's no need to talk, and they talk to you to drain energy, because that's what it really feels like, because it's not really much you want to say. Like, this is just whatever it is. But terrifying, actually, because it puts white people, and I think they're so smart. They're such great master manipulators and psychologists in knowing that deflection is an effective tool at making sure people are not looking at you. Because if we really look at them and place them in context and really just had those conversations, like, it was wide known that white people were cannibals, period.
like, wait a minute, pause, you know? Like, we know certain things, like they're dirty, they don't wash their hands after they use the bathroom, like they barely take showers unless they're told. But I mean, when you begin to put all of it together, in addition to not only did they enslave us and rape us and all this, but you mean to tell me that they ate us and it was this whole thing? Like, I mean, whoa, you know? Like, white people really are the complete opposite of what they've been saying that they are and how we treat them. And even when we talk about how they so-called get off at our pain and suffering and killing, like even the act of killing, like every time those videos now are recording, there's probably white people, specifically white men, watching that, getting aroused by watching white men shoot a gun, the symbolic penis equalizer, young black men. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's absolutely terrifying that at the root of this is a definitely like sexual base root, like emotion that they have, in addition to, you know, fearing genetic annihilation. Like, okay, the nigger baby candies, which was an actual candy, the Africola, the drinking of all black substances like coffee and all that kind of stuff to ingest us even more, or symbolically us, because they couldn't do what they were doing forever, because then the people will definitely rise up. So you have to confuse them and all this other kind of stuff. The black hands, like in Belgium or in the Congo, at least, not in Belgium, but in the Congo, they would count for the number of bullets, and every time that you shot someone, you had to cut off their left hand to prove that you were given a certain number of bullets, you killed this many black African people. And so they actually had a candy, which was black hands. I mean, to suggest that you're only cannibal if you're cannibal, if you physically eat someone's body, is really, really like a superficial and like analysis of the situation. When you like span back to even that kind of stuff, then it just makes them like all suspected racists, but also suspected cannibals at the same time, which, and we just, they're like, they're victims in so many ways. And then I just want, the last thing I wanted to say, I think Toni Morrison, excuse, pardon me, described it as, she said, it's the unspeakable. And I think in addition to having a clear definition of racism, being able to articulate like the depravity of it all and making sure that books like these stay in print and become just common knowledge. Because even when we replace the system of racism, white supremacy, whether white people are here or not, if they are here, it's like we all got to always be looking at them, because they conditioned us. So it's possible we've been conditioned to have a propensity towards homosexual behavior, men and the women, or males and females alike, black males and females alike. You can see it all the time, you know what I mean? But it would also have to mean that they also have some type of like genetic conditioning towards racism, towards homosexuality, pedophilia, and all that. And if not constantly under like supervision and control, they will just do it all over again if given the chance. Like they've never had, there's nothing to take that out. There's never been any reconditioning or any psychological reprogramming. So there it is. That's what it is. And they've just modified it, refined it in our codified terms. So thank you for letting me speak.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Anyone that we've missed, are there any callers that we have not heard from at all?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. Looking forward to this read. I think as long as we're under a global system of racism, white supremacy, that non-white people, especially non-white black people, shouldn't be quote-unquote pussyfooting around with the understanding of racism, white supremacy, what it is and how it works. We need to go straight to it and put out nose and mind right into it, no matter how distasteful it is. That's why I'm looking forward to this book and all other articles of this nature. I can't help but think in my mind about the title of the book, Delectable Negro, I believe it's called. As far as in its first read, it sounds more like the delicious Negro as opposed to what white people have been behaving. And there still is examples of that today. in this part of the world where the majority of the propaganda is controlled and also developed in a place that's called Hollywood. Back a century ago, and not necessarily a century ago, but years ago, they would quickly accuse non-white people, especially non-white black people, of being quote-unquote cannibals in their propagandized movies, Tarzan, the Tarzans, and whatnot. But what you can witness today on how they deflect incorrect behavior is the deflection is actually is a reality of what they actually do, and that's what it seems to be what I'm picking up with this the first reading. So I'm looking forward to it because it seems like it's going to be something that you need to be able to pay attention to and also attempt to share it with other non-white people. Thank you.
For sure. Any other callers that we have not heard from at all? Yes, got all the callers. That's great. I'll share a few thoughts, and then if we have time, if anybody has second thoughts they need to get in, we'll do that as well. Just quickly, I was thinking of like contemporary examples, right? If I was going to make a comparison, Jeffrey Dahmer obviously would be an important one. We had Robert Dvorak on the program back in 2011. He's a white male. He wrote not only did he write an investigation of Jerry Sandusky and the pedophilia that was happening at Penn State unabated for years, he also did a biography on Jeffrey Dahmer. Fascinating that you would have one person do a biography on both of those two incidents. And we talked about them in connection. We talked about the Dahmer situation like within weeks of the Sandusky situation at Penn State, where the football coach was raping all these children. And then we talked about, and he said he was writing a book about Sandusky at the time, and then that book came out about 7 months later, right around the time that Sandusky was convicted in 2012. We had him on the program to talk about the book also, but that would be one. Another contemporary example, the hottest television program in the United States currently, The Walking Dead, all about eating flesh, eating people, and I would say one of the more significant moments where, and this is not zombies, this is just a group of whites. They attack a black person, knock him out, begin eating him, but they don't kill him. They wake him up so that he can see them eating his leg. Number one television program in the U.S. Now, specifically, with this text, number one, any book, he's in the introduction and the number of times the word context is used. Oh man, I thought that was so important, and I thought it was just him really just doing a phenomenal job, much like Harriet Washington, and really setting up so that listeners really understand what he means, and adding historical information so that you understand, like when he says that when he talks about the continent and these slave posts and the slave ship, that all of these, the quote-unquote, the colony, all of these are environments of sexual exploitation, homoeroticism. That's, you know, that is the core. That is the context of all of these environments and the behaviors that happen therein. I thought that was hugely important and really appreciated him taking the time to add that detail. Going to the beginning of the book, the whole time that he put, I thought it was fascinating, one, that he would use that incident as the setup for this book about homoeroticism and cannibalism and all that, his visit to a plantation. Number one, and I've talked about this before, I remember specifically with the American Slave Coast, where they also talk about, you know, going on these plantation tours, Monticello and things like that. I never had an interest in doing any of those type tours. I would love to go now, and I think it could be a great counter-racist exercise to just think of questions. That's what Mr. Woodard did on this tour, just asking questions. I think we could all do that. It would be great. And that's something where you could take your children where they could see you questioning a white person about racism. Really important. And like I said, that's something that before, when I was more confused about racism, I would have never cared to take that sort of visit or tour. Now I would highly recommend it. So even looking at the way that everything about it, it was fascinating that this guy is called, this racist is called everything but just there was a racist running this tour of the plantation in North Carolina. Shout out to Mr. Reed. Mr. Swellfellow. And I get the implications of the description, right? I mean, it's well constructed. I mean, you get a vivid illustration of the scene and what this guy looks like. And he says, after a while, all of us there for the morning tour made our way into the seating area where our tour guide finally came in and stood before us. He wore khaki pants, a maroon polo shirt, and glasses. He was blonde-haired, blue-eyed. Got to mention the, the key details. And those are the features of melanin-deficient humans, individuals classified as white, and stood about 6'3 tall. For the sake of discussion, I will refer to him as Mr. Swellfellow. Like, why are we to think of him as a swellfellow? Why can't it be suspected racist? And this book was edited. This book was published posthumously. So that is something to keep in mind as well. But moving forward, why is that even the name that this racist gets? I don't think they refer to him as a racist at any point in the book. While he continues with the description, he probably lived in the same neighborhood as his mother, if not with his mother, volunteered with the local fire department. Like, he's embodied with all of these virtues. Like, this is just a great all-American guy, and you would just love him, and he spends time with it. He continues. Volunteered with local fire department, had a high school sweetheart he was engaged to, went to church every Sunday, and as far as I could see, wore honesty about his face like a child wears a milky mustache. Again, it's even in my opinion, that metaphor, I say that metaphors, like that's a simile specifically, child wears a milky mustache, where whiteness, milk, I don't think he didn't say chocolate milk or, you know, strawberry milk. Milk is generally something that we relate to white, that white is related to youthful innocence. And this racist at the plantation, I mean, it's fascinating construction and description of someone who is, this is the act of racism, to lie about things that have happened and to minimize and pussyfoot about the terrorism that whites have inflicted on black people worldwide for centuries. Even within that, when he, you know, begins asking a question about the food, with this racist is saying that, you know, The Negroes were well fed on the plantation. And I mean, this is standard. You get this all the time. We've had a number of authors on the program, whites, who come on and they say the same type of thing. Dorothy Bullitt, we had her on about a year ago. She's up here in Washington State, where she said that her family, yes, they owned slaves in Kentucky, but they weren't bad. They weren't practicing terrorism. It wasn't that tough. You know, this is standard operating procedure. And you hear the same thing today when whites try to minimize the abuse and terrorism that they are practicing against black people. But within this whole exchange, when he was describing, like when he said he stopped and he said, I'll read specifically, he says, only after I stopped speaking did I realize I was shaking internally and had taken an edge to my voice. I became aware of my African-American travel companions sitting across the room and the few other white tourists who were part of our morning party. I thought that was hugely important because I know myself and many other victims of white supremacy who have been honest with me have said when they begin bringing up racism and white people get uncomfortable, they know, like, uh-oh, I might be in dangerous territory. If I get a sense that white people are not pleased with what I'm doing or what I'm saying, and I have been in those environments where you know what you're saying and you're challenging a white person and you can see the black people shifting and getting man, I didn't come here for this. I done wasted a whole day for this. And the white people get, man, I bring that up because Mr. Woodard, again, he died in 2008. This book was published in 2014. That is black mental health. He died in his 30s. And just this whole incident, it just sounded so stressful to have to deal with this racist and then this is an educated PhD scholar, you're asking questions to just show what you're talking about is totally bogus, and you're just practicing racism. And that, hush, nigra, they were great. They were well-fed. They had tons of chitlins every day. You don't know what you're – be quiet. And then the other people on the tour are upset. That's how you end up with Gwen Ifill, person we read last, being dead at 61. Mr. Woodard being dead, I believe, at 38. I have to go back and double-check. But, I mean, died way too early. That, right, I think these type of encounters are why you end up with black people dying at such a young age. Let's see. Next, I thought, great question when he said, I responded by asking why such well-fed persons would have provocation to steal meat in the first place. Bam, that's what I mean. Like, I think it could be phenomenal to just go out and ask questions on these tours. That great opportunity where you should be encouraged to ask questions. I thought this was a great paragraph here where he says, in Slavery and Social Death, a Comparative Study, Orlando Patterson, I think that might be a cowbell. I think he's married to a white person. Nevertheless, describes slavery as a parasitic institution that white masters strove to conceal in ideology and act. According to Patterson, the slaveholder, in order to maintain an image of himself as civilized and free of parasitic appetites, camouflaged his dependence, his parasiticism, by various ideological strategies. Paradoxically, he defined the slave as dependent. This is consistent with the human technique of camouflaging in relation by defining it as the opposite of what really is. Parasite is the perfect concept for my purposes. I thought that was brilliantly written and gets right to the core of how whites, really the core of white culture and how they relate to non-whites, really black people particularly. It is parasitic by nature, has to be. And again, going back to them being a global minority. And I thought that was another great illustration. I'm just stealing. Emmy made a great point yesterday, formerly 1842, about saying that just the damage of whites projecting and calling non-white people minorities when they are the minority. I think that's another illustration of them camouflaging what really is and defining things by the opposite of what they really are. Whites do that all the time, one of the greatest tricks of the racists. Let's see. I will see if I can share maybe two more things. The pictures in the book, the cartoons that he's talking about, it's worth it alone to get a copy of the book just so you can see some of those illustrations. Definitely one I have to mention, Carol Walker. I don't know if people are familiar with her. She is an extraordinarily talented artist, black female. She's pretty attractive too, but she has done a number of just incredible exhibits dealing with black people and white supremacy. She did, and right on topic with this consumption, she made a statue. I have to post it, or she made a structure. It was of like the stereotypical image of like a black mammy figure on a plantation, a black female on a plantation, but it was made all out of sugar. And it was gigantic. Like, they have pictures of it and what have you, but it's all in sugar. And she did it for a number of reasons, emphasizing the role that sugar played in the enslavement and terrorism of black people. It was kind of sexual. And the sweetness, she said she was playing on that too with the consumption, the sweetness of the dark, melanated black female body. But Carl Walker, he has a great passage where she says, commenting upon European and white cannibalism, has observed that there is a little bit of masochism, so much love and hate involved in eating something to kill something and eat it. It's very sexual, very sensual. I'd say the epitome of that is that structure she made out of sugar of the black female body. And the last point I'll get in, let's see. Oh, I got a book. I think I closed my iBook, but when he was talking about the slave ship in New England, where they ended up eating for black people, they wrote a whole book about that. I'll get the title before we go off the air, but I got that book if people are interested. Let's see. Maybe I don't need to get in. I'm comfortable resting right there.
I think yes. I will be comfortable resting right there. I think I had all of my notes. I will make. Oh, Samuel Cartwright. That'll be my last one. That should be of the people that read Medical Apartheid. She mentioned Samuel Cartwright in that book specifically. Samuel Cartwright is the same person who came up with the concept of draptomania, where a black person, if you attempt to escape the plantation, you must be crazy or have some sort of psychosis trying to escape the kindly white masters who have, you know, been more than generous with their watermelon and chitlin allocations. Did anybody have anything they need to get in before we get to the second audio segment? We have about 3 minutes. Oh, everybody satisfied? That's fine too. Nobody needed anything they needed to add?
I'm here.
May I speak?
Heard both of you. I guess we'll get Rob in Wisconsin first.
I was just going to mention the part about when I think it was the black female that got caught stealing food and then was placed somewhere outside. Her leg was frozen and then amputated. That stood out as well. Metaphoric acts. If anyone has a book and they could touch on that, if they, maybe in the next segment, metaphoric acts, I had that highlighted. But the other thing that I wanted to say was that this book brings into, I guess, makes a lot of other books kind of make sense, brings them into context, Sentence to Science, guy in Philadelphia when he was talking about all of the prison rape that was going on and black males being the number one rape gender because of all the prison rapes. And it was, he specifically stated that it was the correctional officers that was facilitating and or orchestrating the anti-sexual behavior. Thank you.
Was it one other person that was going to speak briefly?
Yes. I just briefly wanted to get in. Regarding the use of words, and especially since you gave the example of the artist who made the manly figure of completely a figure, and I think someone said something about not using the word gentleman. We haven't even got deeply into the book, and I feel I have a lot of emotions about words that I've been using, such as sweetie, honey, even the word sugar, as far as I know, I grew up in the South, so you hear people say, hey, give me some sugar to little children. I've already started to feel that way about these words, and we're not even, we haven't even gotten through, you know, the chapter one yet. I feel there's going to be a lot of shift as far as just my personal code and words that I will not be using, because now, after reading some of this, I have no doubt the origins of these words have to deal with the consumption of specifically black bodies. Thank you.
Hey, guys, could I get in something briefly?
Yes, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, thank you. I just wanted to speak to the black female, I think it might have been Emmy, I'm not sure if it was her, had brought up the cutting off of hands in Belgium, and it made me think that also they used to use the hands of silverback gorillas as well as the hands of black people for ashtrays. And it also made me think of Belgium again specifically because when black women didn't meet their quota for rubber, they would cut off their breasts and let them bleed to death. And for black men, they would tie their naked bodies after beating them to four horses pointing in opposite directions and then beat the horses and split the men in half. Or into quarters. So these are all things we have to keep in mind. These are all forms of visual consumption, and Lord knows how many of them they probably ate. Thank you.
Can I be good really quick before we move on?
30 seconds.
Okay. For the person who called for the metaphoric acts, it's on page 6. So when you get your book, you don't have to re-listen to everything to try to find it. It's on page 6 towards the bottom, and the sentence is, most of my examples of consumption on and off the plantation range from the literal murder and eating of black persons to what we might think of as metaphoric acts. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Grand. We will get started with the second audio segment. Again, we're still in the introduction. For people who are following along, I think I can tell you exactly where we're picking up. We're at the subheading Slavery as History and Memory. That's what we're picking up at, still in the introduction. Real pleasure to be able to read the text. This is the late Vincent Woodard, The Delectable Negro, Human Consumption and Homoeroticism Within U.S. Slave Culture, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number 2.
Slavery as History and Memory. Much of contemporary scholarship on the African diaspora or the Black Atlantic has tended to follow Gilroy's path, emphasizing routes of transmission instead of the roots of origins and cultural legacies. An unfortunate result of this approach to the Black Atlantic is that, as Houston Baker Jr. notes, much of the multi-locational history of specific diasporic communities gets erased or overlooked. In particular, Baker takes issue with Gilroy's mishandling of the history and legacy of slavery and bondage. The Black Atlantic remains surprisingly abstract and interdeterminate with respect to the very chronotype the book claims as an analytical organizing symbol, namely ships in motion across the spaces between Europe, America, Africa, and the Caribbean. In fact, after early mention, ships virtually disappear from Gilroy's work. They disappear as chronotypes, material vessels transplanting Black populations, dread transports of conquered peoples to penal colonies of the Americas. Ships as disciplinary and carceral holds on the shackled Black body receive no extensive treatment in the Black Atlantic. As Baker does in Turning South Again, Rethinking Modernism, Rereading Booker T, I also aim to bring together ships and plantations. For this issue of roots of cultural transmission is not simply a matter of revising or changing the master narrative from Eurocentric to African origins of Black American culture. Rather, at stake in this debate over cultural origins is a deeper understanding of the ways in which, for example, the penal politics of slavery and chattel bondage speak to current political phenomena, such as the incarceration of Black people and Black men in particular, economic issues of racial reparations, and the larger systemic sedimentation of racial inequality, and issues of trauma and post-traumatic stress that affect the ideological and material aspects of Black uplift politics and communities. To give a more concrete example of the contemporary implications of the cultural origins debate, in Chapter 5, I examine how William Styron's historical novel, The Confessions of Nat Turner, occasioned the first ever public debate on the subject of homosexuality in the context of slavery. This national debate, occurring in the 1960s, demonstrated how, for Black people, the memory of slavery and questions of cultural origins attached to the slave ship had profound political implications rooted in the history and memory of slavery. My transhistorical approach to slavery is informed, in part, by contemporary calls in African American cultural studies for the excavation of documented materials on the subject of homoeroticism during slavery. Many Black gay scholars in the 1990s saw their contemporary dislocation from Black communities and political infrastructures as linked to a larger history of dislocation and silencing dating back, at least, to slavery. Charles I. Nero, for example, felt that 1980s Afrocentrists, Black arts spokespersons, and Black power advocates might have changed their ideas about Black gays as threats to and pariahs within Black families had they known that homoeroticism existed during slavery. Referencing a few antebellum court cases in which Black men were persecuted for sodomy offenses, Nero wrote, "Although the evidence for homosexual practices among Black male slaves is small, it does suggest that we do not exclude homoeroticism from life on the plantation." Beyond these instances of criminalization, Nero concludes that additional evidence of homosexuality excavated from diaries, letters, and narratives would go a long way towards helping us revise our models of the Black family and of homosexuality as alien to Black culture. Intuitively, Black gay men understood the issue of homosexuality during slavery as a complex phenomenon shaped by a number of factors, including the nation's unresolved relationship to the legacy of slavery, Black liberation ideology dating back to slavery, and, most importantly, the maintenance of traditional notions of family and community that originated in the 18th and 19th centuries. The legacy and memory of slavery had a powerful effect that left many Black gay men feeling isolated from and rendered invisible within Black communities. Joseph B. Eames said it first and best, "I cannot go home as who I am. When I speak of home, I mean not only the familial constellation from which I grew, but the entire Black community, the Black press, the Black church, Black academicians, the Black literati, and the Black left. I am most often rendered invisible, perceived as a threat to the family, or am tolerated if I am silent and inconspicuous." Beam's comments echo back through time to the threatening relationship between the homosexual Bayard Rustin and the civil rights movement, and, before Rustin, to the homosexual threat that Augustus Dill represented to the Crisis magazine and W.E.B. Du Bois. Both Rustin and Dill experienced scandalous public sex incidents in the 1950s and 1920s, respectively, that involved arrests and, in Rustin's case, widely circulated media attention. Both men, loyal and dedicated racial liberation advocates, were asked by key Black figures to remove themselves from organizing centers of the civil rights and Reconstruction movements. As Philip Bryan Harper has noted, the Black homosexual function in the 20th century as an index for Black masculine anxieties. These range from the very personal and painful anxieties of lynching, castration, and the denial of civil rights to a larger set of anxieties rooted in historical erasure and cultural genocide. Black gays in the late 20th century found themselves in a double bind of history and memory, which had an unfortunate result. Black people equated their sexual identities with homosexual violation dating back to slavery. In response to this dynamic, such Black gay scholars as Robert F. Reed Farr, Derek Scott, Nero, Marlon Ross, Charles Clifton, Dwight A. McBride, Harper, Lyndon Barrett, and Ron Simmons, among others, took this opportunity to historicize their sexual identities and subject positions and to call attention to the ways in which Black people, at least since the Reconstruction era, have conflated the legacy of homosexuality during slavery with the 20th century notion of the Black faggot, or Negro homosexual. For example, Eldridge Cleaver associated anal sex between a white man and Black man with a racial death wish extending back to slavery and with miscegenation. Cleaver conflated his contemporary understanding of the homosexual person with the particular and different ways in which homosexuality was thought of and configured in the context of slavery. Working with Cleaver's idea of the Negro homosexual, Reed Farr asserts, in Black Gay Man, that to be fucked in the ass by the white man is not simply to be overcome by white culture, white intellect, white notions of superiority. Contradicting Cleaver, Reed Farr suggests that the act of anal penetration, at least in the realm of memory, opens up space for the reconstruction of the Black imaginary such that the most sacrosanct of Black truths might be transgressed. Truly, the inability to creatively imagine homosexuality during slavery reflected a fundamental fear within the Black collective of moving outside of the normative categories of masculinity, reproduction, pleasure, and family. Elaborating on this point, Reed Farr notes that Black people are most accustomed to thinking of Black female violation during slavery because this theme resonates with a long history of Black American literature and lore in which the licentious white man acts as the absolute spoiler of Black desire.
Reed Farr's assertions are borne out in the heart-trending depictions in black men's slave narratives and autobiographies of black mothers, daughters, and wives raped by white men, or the whole lynching and raping dynamic wherein black men are the historical objects of lynching and castration, and black women serve as the historical objects of rape. The image of the white southerner fucking the black man, however, throws all this into confusion, Reed Farr contends. It did not occur to Cleaver or to many of his compatriots in the 1960s that a sexually receptive black man during slavery might have absolutely nothing to do, historically speaking, with a self-declared cosmopolitan homosexual man living in the 1960s or 1990s. In the 20th century, our most prevalent examples of same-sex contact during slavery have tended to focus on anal rape and other types of sexual abuse, a fact that underscores this issue of memory, or, more specifically, the failure and inability to imagine homosexuality in complicated ways during slavery. This was the problem that Nero had with Morrison's depiction of black men preferring sex with animals and performing forced fellatio on white prison guards in Beloved. Deborah McDowell suggests that in order to see black masculinity during slavery in a more complicated frame, we may have to revise our prevailing genealogy, our way of locating black male heroicism and virility at the center of black uplift and liberation in the 19th century. Citing Douglass's slave narratives, McDowell focuses on his omission of his matrilineal legacy, suggesting that his gender, sex, and uplift politics derive from the female body, black subjugation, mother hunger and loss, rape and sexual violation, as opposed to the genealogy of white male dominance and authority that Douglass foregrounds. A black feminist, E. Frances White, has admitted that for her and many others, the issue of homosexuality during slavery brings to the surface ambivalent feelings. Nevertheless, she encourages scholars of the African-American experience to explore the implications of homosexual rape and its relationship to heterosexual rape. Furthermore, she advocates that we inquire with Morrison-like curiosity why historians have presented the African-American past as if the only sexual concerns that black men had during slavery were castration, and whether they could protect, and for some control, black women's bodies. Baker enacted just such a revision when he asserted, in Turning South Again, that there existed a deeply homoerotic bond between Booker T. Washington and all white men, but in particular, and most expressly between the Wizard of Tuskegee and General Armstrong. Baker's comments, while speculative and cautious in his text, reflect a gradual turning within African American scholarship towards the erotic and interior lives of black men during slavery. All told, we have at the end of the 20th century a collective call and move to excavate homoerotic materials and theoretical frameworks as a means of redefining and better understanding African American and larger American experience. The Delectable Negro responds to this collective call for a deeper, more useful understanding of homosexuality in the context of slavery by focusing on the 19th century as a moment in which black masculinity, racial identity, homoeroticism, and a distinctive American appetite for black male flesh and soul congealed. I concur with Maurice O. Wallace that still today, too few critics and historians have pursued the problems and paradoxes inherent in black male enslavement. Wallace's excellent and wide-ranging study, Constructing the Black Masculine, Identity and Ideality in African American Men's Literature and Culture, 1775 through 1995, Foreground Sexuality, Homosocial Behavior, and Black Masculine Anxiety as Crucial Social and Theoretical Frames for Black Masculine Studies, focusing on the 18th and 19th centuries.
His approach to the study of black masculinity marks a general shift echoed in more recent works that deal explicitly and implicitly with black masculinity in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Among them, Turning South Again, Rethinking Modernism, Rethinking Booker T, Manning the Race, Reforming Black Men in the Jim Crow Era, Impossible Witnesses, Truth, Abolitionism, and Slave Testimony, Are We Not Men? Masculine Anxiety and the Problem of African American Identity, and Conjugal Union, The Body, The House, and the Black American. No study on black masculinity in the 19th century focuses on homoeroticism. This has partly to do with issues of material evidence that have been duly noted by scholars of the African American experience. Many have argued that there simply are not enough primary materials available to conduct such a study. Contrary, though, to these claims of absence, I argue that homoeroticism did exist among 19th century black peoples, chattel or free, literate or non-literate, through a number of factors have prevented us from being able to discern and engage with the subject of homoeroticism as it existed then. Most importantly, our contemporary framing of homosexuality has obscured our vision. In addition, the absence of appropriate linguistic apparatus, the dearth of historical documentation, and the lack of theoretical models with which to excavate homoeroticism from extant historical documents have all contributed to a lack of substantive information on the subject of homoeroticism. The extant materials on homoeroticism that I work with in this study include slave narratives, Works Progress Administration interviews of ex-slaves, advertisements for runaway slaves, neo-slave narratives, journals, diaries, novels, poetry, and historical fiction. Most of the materials that I work with are staples of African American literature and culture, such as the slave narratives of Harriet Jacobs and Frederick Douglass. Other materials, such as James L. Smith's slave narrative, advertisements for runaway slaves, and numerous articles from black newspapers published in the 19th century, are additions to the archive. In this way, I have attempted to respond to the call for the excavation of materials on the subject of homoeroticism during slavery. The chapters of the book conform to my theoretical framing of homoeroticism in the context of cannibal culture and as a derivative of African homosexual practices reconstituted in the Americas. Chapter 1, Cannibalism in Transatlantic Context, opens with an examination of Olauda Equiano's well-known slave narrative, the interesting narrative of the life of Olauda Equiano or Gustavus Vassa, the African, written by himself. Equiano's narrative brings together the themes of homoeroticism and cannibalism. It gives ample examples of Europeans and West Africans' belief about cannibalism in the context of young Equiano's romantic, chivalric relationship formed aboard a slave ship with a young white American lad from the slave-owning South. Scholars have tended to dismiss the depictions of cannibalism in the narrative. I treat them seriously and use them to establish an interconnection between cannibalism and chattel homoeroticism, and to establish a transatlantic context for incidents of cannibalism and homoerotic interactions in U.S. plantation culture that I discuss in the second chapter. In Chapter 2, Sex, Honor, and Human Consumption, I examine literal and symbolic examples of human consumption in the antebellum United States. I begin with a discussion of the above-mentioned Essex affair, which involved the consumption of four black men in the 19th century. Isolating issues of male secrecy, shame, and honor inherent in the Essex affair, I move to a broader discussion of the same issues in the slave narratives of black men who documented their social consumption. Finally, in the context of black male lives and voices, I look at the widespread 19th century concern over whether the United States was becoming a cannibal nation. This debate, which occurred among the clergy, congressmen,
judges, and artists, among others, centered upon slavery as an essentially consumptive institution. The third chapter, A Tale of Hunger Retold, Ravishment and Hunger in F. Douglass's Life and Writing, focuses on Frederick Douglass's depiction of human consumption as a phenomenon that ate away at the psyche and soul. None was more articulate than Douglass about how these dimensions of the consumption of slaves eroded one's ability to resist and strategize against slavery. His observations in this chapter provide a blueprint for how the slave struggled in mind, emotions, and spirit, not only against social consumption, but also against endemic mechanisms of starvation and hunger designed to break the enslaved person. Douglass's own hunger for self, familial and ancestral bonds, and civil status manifested as complex erotic ties to white men and cross-gender behavior. Douglass's gender-variant and homoerotic experiences provide an opportunity to think anew about 19th century models of black masculinity as gender-variant and tied to emotional, erotic urges. The focus of Chapter 4, Incest and Human Consumption, is Harriet Jacobs' Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl. Jacobs' narrative depicts some of the more graphic scenes of human consumption ever portrayed in a U.S. slave narrative. She depicts masters within the domestic realm as epicures of black flesh, sex, terror, and institutionalized hunger and starvation, focusing on Luke, a black man raped by his master, and Jacobs herself. I elucidate the intersections between incestuous plantation dynamics and the culture of human consumption. Both Luke and Jacobs are infantilized and form a part of a genealogy of human consumption that, for the master and mistress, extends back to childhood and learned, sycophantic relationships with mammy figures, black uncle figures, and black playmates. Chapters 5 and 6 look at the topic of human consumption from more contemporary perspectives. Chapter 5, Eating Nat Turner, focuses on William Styron's novel, The Confessions of Nat Turner. This novel, along with 10 Black Writers Respond, the edited black response to the novel, marked the first time that the subject of homosexuality during slavery had received sustained public debate. I focus on what many black intellectuals and activists called Styron's homosexual representation of and degradation of Nat Turner's life and revolutionary efforts. Other black male critics of Styron's novel accuse him of effeminizing and cannibalizing Nat Turner. As I've mentioned, Turner's corpse was treated in a manner that suggests it might have been consumed as medicine and dispensed as a component of pharmacological serums. In this chapter, I explore homoeroticism and cannibalism as transhistorical phenomena, linking the consumptive history presented in chapters 1 and 2 to the political insurgence of the 1960s. The final chapter of the book, Chapter 6, The Hungry Nigger, opens with an examination of the controversy surrounding the chain gang oral sex scene in Toni Morrison's Beloved. Black male responses to this scenario, and the novel in general, have ranged from accusations of homophobia to a lambasting of Morrison's valorization of black suffering, to reading the scene as psychoanalytic encapsulation of black male erotic life on the plantation. I suggest that the profound usefulness of this scenario is in conveying how, at the end of the 20th and beginning of the 21st century, we are still at a loss for language and appropriate metaphors with which to describe black male hunger within plantation culture of consumption. Hunger serves in the novel as an index for a culture of consumption, for black male emotional loss, trauma, and need, and for a complex black male erotic life. I draw parallels between Morrison's novels and late 19th century neo-slave narratives. From Morrison's novel, I segue into a more formal theoretization of what I call the black male orifice. This section of the chapter takes into account the long-standing historical challenge of theorizing and thinking through black male erotic orifices, the anus and mouth in particular. Working with Baker's notion of the tight place, I suggest that we need to ground these erotic regions, along with the notion of black men hungering, in actual historical places. To this end, I sketch a genealogy of the black male orifice that recuperates the Middle Passage, plantation slavery, and transatlantic slavery as homoerotic and erogenous zones of black male experience. As a final prelude, I pose the question, what if the 19th century cannibalism question and debate pointed in a direction of inquiry we desperately needed to resolve? And from this side of things, what if we in this contemporary moment have a responsibility to make sense of that question, tracing its outgrowths to our current political and social climates?
Context of white supremacy. That will do it for this week's audio readings. We'll pick up. So we'll be on chapter one next week. We just concluded the introduction. So we'll start right at the beginning of chapter one for next Friday. If you have commentary you would like to share, the number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. We should have about 30 minutes, ample time. If you have commentary you would like to share, do not lollygag. Do not wait till the last minute. Go ahead and get your hand up now, and that way we can get you on the line, whatever commentary you'd like to share. Everyone who dialed in who has a hand up, your line should be open. Feel free to participate.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Rob in Milwaukee, still growing. A few observations. I guess the first observation that really stood out, I got the impression that the author was saying that homosexuality was already a part of quote-unquote black culture. And if I'm wrong, somebody please correct me on that. the part about where it was speaking about Ed Eldridge Cleaver and his thoughts on homosexuality brought me, his thoughts, and then the person that they had contrasting what he was saying brought me back to the what I shared on workplace racism yesterday about the young black male in the city or worker. And I wrote down, when he started to speak about black masculinity in the 19th century, and I just highlighted that it was so complex. I was trying to write and listen at the same time, so kind of missed that one. Thanks for letting me share. I'm Mute Milan.
Any other folks have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
There was one brief section that really stood out to me, and just as the reading was going on, and first, I give a big shout out to the narrator. He's doing an exceptional job, and I just thank him for being the foundation of us being to follow along with the book, even for those who may not have it. But the section that stood out to me most, it said, in fact, after early mention, ships virtually disappear from Gilroy's works. They disappear as phenotypes, material vessels transplanting black populations, dread transports of conquered peoples to penal colonies of the Americas. Ships as disciplinary and carceral holes on the shackled black body received no extensive treatment in the black Atlantic. What stood out to me was the idea of the ships being dreaded transports of conquered people to penal colonies of the Americas. And the term penal colony, to me, really, it's weird because penal and penis sound very similar. And in the context of when you're in prison, you're in a situation where you have no feminine contact, so it facilitates this illicit sexual rape and activity as byproduct of just having pure separation from the female sex for extended periods of time. And the same thing happened on the slave ship. They never put the men and women together. They had them separate. So when you look at the English language and the fact that you have the word penal, P-E-N-A-L, and penile, P-E-N-I-L-E, they're very close in sound, but they mean two different things. But in context, they work in tandem with each other as far as white racist culture, because they've actually turned the entire world into a global penal colony of white supremacy. So that stood out to me just simply because the slave ship itself was indicative of the same experience that our black males have in prison to this day, where they're just isolated in these hyper-violent, homoerotic environments, and they're left to their own devices to the amusement of the white people who oversee their daily activities and their reality as black men in the new plantations of modern life. So thank you, and I'll mute my line.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
So one of the questions that I posed while I was listening to the text following along was, I don't know if he's going to in this text, and if he does, that doesn't take anything away from the text at all. But if you've been conditioned, then you're aware of your conditioning, like you realize that you've been conditioned, does having a physiological response demand that you are, like, that you accept that that's you? Like, and the reason I pose it is, you know, for instance, there was I remember I read something once, a young girl had been raped or something. As a matter of fact, it couldn't even been real. It could have been, like, on SVU. But she, like, orgasmed, but she was raped. So she didn't feel like, she was like, well, if I orgasmed, but I was raped, does that mean that I was raped? So in the context of the reading, if a male has a response to an image or a touch or something, does that make him gay? And so I don't have the answer to that question, but it's one that I'm posing as I read throughout the text. And then hunger is mentioned throughout the text many, many times. And I can sense why he's using the term hunger, because it's one of those words that can be on many levels and mean many things and speak to, depending how you read it, many different things. But I've also thought about as well the, like, hunger on the African continent, like just actual hunger, and the need for, like, medicine. And there was a documentary, I think, like, Finding a Pedophile or something like that, and some British male went over there and had, like, a whole compound and everything set up, and he had just been raping primarily little black boys. And in exchange for them to have a place to sleep that night or food or whatever it was. And so this keeping all of us so hungry in whatever fashion it is, whether it's actually being hungry for food or being just needy in some sort, whether it's of our job or validation, whatever, ensures that the whole world will stay white people's racist man, racist woman, and racist child, their brothel. Because I've even, they're like young white missionaries go over to the continent and are constantly raping the children there, and then it comes out later and nothing happens. And, you know, all of that is conditioning. And so, you know, it's so much like that. I don't think that the text could really speak to it, but the psychological conditioning of molestation, of rape, and then what that does if you have a physiological response, and then if you have to continue doing it, does, you know, you ask yourself those questions, well, does that make me that? And then there's nothing to address that, and then it becomes an identity, which is what I saw when I was listening and reading along with the second part. BGQ to all the folks in the past who have had to grapple with this and who were writing about it, and this is just like little quotes from their work, so their work could possibly address what I'm about to say, but it sounds more like justification than it does like analysis. And like he says, and I mean, I put stars all next to this on page 22, that to be
effed in the ass by a white man or by the white man is not simply to be overcome by white culture, white intellect, white notions of superiority. Contradicting Cleaver, Reed Farr suggests that the act of anal penetration, at least in the realm of memory, opens up space for the reconstruction of the black imaginary such that the most sacrosanct of black truths might be transgressed. That seems like justification. That seems like trying to make something that really probably doesn't make sense, or something that wouldn't even be that deep if it did make sense, you know, mean something. And that just sounds like not really looking at the problem, like another form of deflection. And I listened to it and a few other things like that, not necessarily speaking, because, you know, it can be, like, I can see this having many ripple effects. One black man being raped, one seeing another black man being raped, maybe he had a physiological response, maybe he engaged in some behavior that another black male saw, they were raped. Like, even with the story with the black men in the prison, when it's nuts to butts, I think, even that, like, what does that mean? Like, what if you got hard while that was happening? How do you respond to yourself then? How do the other men around you respond? How do you feel about yourself? Like, all of those questions, you know what I mean? And then repeatedly over and over again, you can condition an individual. White people know that. They know about conditioning us, or people in general, but specifically us. So anyway, there's a constant mentioning of infantilizing us. That just means to me pedophilic. Like, we will be adults, but you say we're children. So you're looking at us like children, even though we're older, which means that that's just another form of, like, symbolic, metaphoric, ritualistic, maybe abstract pedophilia. Mother hunger, which is a term I haven't heard before. So I didn't even think about that. But then if there's mother hunger, then there has to be father hunger. And what that would mean, like, what you and that, you know, psychologically, if you don't have that, then, like, you know, and I've heard it in different ways, but never mother hunger. So I'm grateful for the term to be able to, you know, be a little bit more succinct. And then just the last thing is just shame. Like, I know the book will touch on that, touched on it a couple times, but, you know, I believe that there are some people who might just really be gay. But I don't think it's the rapes that we're seeing now, which means that there's a lot of people who are not aware. Like, you know, they don't know who they are, where they are, what time it is. So they don't pass the mental health test, in the words of Dr. Francis Wellsing. They don't pass the test. So they're, like, we're all victims. And I think that's a form of extreme victimization, to be so confused at the sexual level, and then even so further to be confused at your, like, gender level, too. Like, it's a very terrible thing. And I don't really see that many people being able to recover from that. So it's very sad in that, like, what has happened in the past is definitely sad, and how it's, like, rippling and coming out now is even more sad, because there's no system or institution in place to help people come to terms with that, heal with that, fix it, and move on, so that we can build, you know, our own institutions or families or whatever it is. With that, I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you, Connie. Other folks that anybody we have not heard from, you should speak now if we haven't heard from you at all.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening to all the callers. Hopped in late. I had an appointment, but picked up a little bit of interesting read. I started reading a little earlier today, and I got the Kindle, so I took some notes, but a couple things just stood out. It was a paragraph. And it started, said, the legacy and memory of slavery had a powerful effect that left me, black gay men, feeling isolated and rendered invisible within black communities. Joseph Beam said it first and best, I cannot go home as who I am. When I speak of home, I mean not only the familial constellation from which I grew, but the entire black community, the black press, the black church, the black academics. And it continues, but I was just thinking about that and just saying they felt visible. They felt all these feelings, and even with all these feelings of shame, they're still being dominated by racism. And that's where all of this kind of rolls together. It's just really interesting how you have a dynamic with a dynamic, and these people are still being dominated. And even another part I was thinking about is that, and I'm not sure if he's going to go into this, but maybe the jobs and the positions that white supremacy during the antebellum period was their masculinity, or this homoeroticism, was this a determination also on where they were placed, what jobs they did, who did what? Because you never really talk about why certain people were chosen to do certain positions, obviously based upon some skilled labor, but also some of the personalities and tendencies. And did some of the white masters that participated with some of these black males, allegedly, quote unquote, was that some of the reasoning that they chose some of these people to do certain tasks, or, you know, they kind of catered to them, even while being dominated? Not like they had any great benefits from any of this, but I just found that really, really interesting. Difficult read for me, but I'm getting through it. But really interesting, all victims. And then I took another note. And the last one was his observations in this chapter provide a blueprint for how the slaves struggled in mind, emotions, and spirit, not only against social consumption, but also against endemic mechanisms of starvation and hunger, designed to break the enslaved person. And it just seems like this whole thing was just breaking them and just destroying the mind. And, you know, even when we were, when you guys were reading, The Half Has Never Been Told, the sexual nature of slavery, I don't even think the system existed for anything other than that, period. Homosexual, male, female, it just seems like that was a huge portion of it. Sometimes it seemed like it's bigger than, and I could be wrong, but it seems like it was bigger than the economic part. It just seems like whether white males were lusting over females or males, that, you know, these 500,000 people got their blood shed during the Civil War because they just couldn't have their Negroes anymore. That's just what I'm getting from it, and I just wanted to share my thoughts, and I'll mute my line. Thanks, guys.
Other folks have commented. They wanted to make sure they got in.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I just from like listening and following along and everything, when it started talking about the homo eroticism in it, I think that it shows how anti-sexual behavior was introduced into our community. And I think that a lot of it continues in the community because we don't know how to cope with it. And I mute my line.
I don't want other folks on the line that have not shared since the second audio segment ended. Anyone that we haven't heard from? We get everybody, nobody that has been left out since the second audio segment ended.
Yes, Matthew.
Yes, sir.
Yes, I, just like the last caller, I have a similar opinion. I feel that Mr. Woodard paints a good context of the behavior from the 18th, 19th up till today. And we really don't, I think it's very difficult for a non-white person, confused or less confused, to really understand anti-sexual, homoerotic, homosexual activity today, although they were different. He makes a note that the whole social context of them were different, but it's hard to understand that with understanding this. So I'm really happy that I'm actually reading this information because it's helping me to understand where this came from and how today the consumption, in quotes, via the entertainment industry and, you know, the pornographic industry and all the other industries where non-white people are used, it's a complete continuation. It's almost like we're just reading the way that they went about it at that time. I did want to comment a little bit on Frederick Douglass. I think it was in the first section he spoke about how this could have dampened the image that we have of Frederick Douglass as this, you know, hyper-masculine black superhero, as sometimes they want to paint him during the month of February. Big shout outs too, because I believe, you know, we'll be going through reading this book during Black History Month, and I think this is extremely important. Taking into account how Carter G. Woodson really wanted us to really go deep, Negro History Week. I feel that this is going to take us there. But I feel that it's very difficult. I think a lot maybe of the male callers feel the same way, to read some of these passages and to kind of just put ourselves in those pictures. And the questions of what is not African activity. I believe a previous caller said something about, I believe this could have been assumed, Vincent Woodard assuming that this was a part of African culture. I also feel that from other readings as well as this one, that is a type of inference, but I believe they have different contexts. I believe they're placed them in different, they're not the same ideology, because as we think of homosexuality today, which was seen at different times during history as different ideas of what homosexuality was. But again, very grateful to be reading, especially during Black History Month. Thank you.
Anyone else who hasn't been able to share since the second audio segment concluded?
Ma'am, Kurt?
Yes, ma'am.
I just want to make a quick comment that I thought it was definitely very interesting about about the author's position on the book, The Confessions of Nat Turner. Because I did like how he did mention that there were other Black people during that time that the book was released that they kind of opposed it and debated it, because I also take the position that the first Confessions of Nat Turner, it kind of humanized him to the whites that were definitely fearful. But then I think his name was William, I forgot the last name, how he basically took it and completely changed it around to make it more of this, going along with the lines of the book of being more homoerotic. So I definitely thought that was interesting. It definitely didn't seem like it that book, the second one, the second Confessions of Nat Turner, it seemed like it was more of a fantasy rather than of some real truth. So I guess that's basically all I have. Thank you. I'll mute my line.
Right on. Anybody else that we missed? Second audio segment? Anybody? Grant, I will assume we got everyone. Just some of the quick notes that I wanted to share. That notion in the second audio segment, where they were talking about, you know, if we heard about this homoeroticism that was happening rampant in white culture and on the plantations in the U.S., that, you know, it might lower our stature of how we think of Frederick Douglass, if he was being raped by racist white male plantation owners, or they were eating Black people and, you know, thinking about raping and or eating Frederick Douglass. And to me, the absurdity is, why wouldn't that change my opinion of whites? Not the victim, not how I think of Frederick Douglass, who was trying to do everything he could to save himself. Why wouldn't that change my opinion of whites, where they just opened the book? Mr. Swellfellow telling me that, hey, they were right kindly and gave us all the victuals we could eat. Instead of thinking of that, thinking that, oh my Lord, they are raping cannibalist savages who are enslaving and beating and doing all this other stuff, torturing my family. Why wouldn't it change our opinion of white people? It's just astounding, that pattern of us, the attention not being on white maldoers, racists. Continuing, this book got a lot of awards in queer studies departments, or just the discipline of queer studies and LGBT studies. It seemed like they had some good things to say, so I think there will be a lot of work to interrogate in this text as we go. The portion, let's see, that I picked out some of the stuff in the second reading, where he says, Joseph Beam said it first and best, "I cannot go home as who I am. When I speak of home, I mean not only the familial constellation from which I grew, but the entire Black community, Black press, Black church, blah, blah, blah." I think it was read before.
just that whole notion, I've heard it before. It reminded me so much of Cleo Monago, this notion. To me, it suggests, in the way that I hear it discussed, that racism is a problem, and then black homophobia, because it'll be black people specifically that'll get called out, black homophobia against other black gay people is equally as bad, maybe even worse. That's the way that it'll get presented, which is, it's not accurate. It's absurd, but I mean, if we just really want to be codified about it, it is totally inaccurate. I feel like that is grossly misrepresented all the time. I don't think you're going to be able to get a coalition of gay black people and say that, oh yeah, black people in the U.S. are keeping me from getting a job, or keeping me from going to school, or keeping me from getting a loan, keeping me from getting housing. Every time I put in an application, some black person comes and says, we don't do no, gay black people here. Get on out of here. All right. And they, kick the... Where is that? What are you even talking about? If you're just talking about black people being discourteous to you, join the club. That's one of the main products of the system of white supremacy, is anti-black behavior. And even the notion of black people having a home, it sounds painfully similar to the idea of there being a black community where you can just go and be welcome. That does not exist in the system of white supremacy, period. That's just, in my view, just a lot of rhetoric that comes out of racist dominated, the whole racist subdivision of the gay rights movement, and the confusion it spawns when you can attack someone's genitals or how they think about their genitals and what they should be doing with them. Continuing. This is right below the passage I just read on the same page. Both men, he's talking about Bayard Rustin and the, abuse that he was subjected to during the 1960s, his involvement in the civil rights movement. Both men loyal, and W.E.B. Du Bois, both men loyal and dedicated racial liberation advocates, were asked by key black figures to remove themselves from organizing centers of the civil rights and reconstruction movements. As Philip Bryan Harper has noted, the black homosexual function in the 20th century as an index for black masculine anxieties. These ranged for the very personal and painful anxieties of lynching, castration, and the denial of civil rights, to a larger set of anxieties rooted in historical erasure and cultural genocide. I found that I had problems with it on numerous levels. There are so many black people who were terrorized and ostracized during the what is known as the civil rights period for a litany of reasons, by black people, by white people, even some of that distancing of Bayard Rustin. White people were at the root of some of that. It was, we're going to get in trouble with white people. Bayard Rustin is, they said he was a communist, which they said about tons of black people. Even a lot of that was responding to racism, white supremacy. Same pattern again, where the focus, the blame gets focused on black people and the nasty, evil black homophobe, and not racist man, racist woman, racist child, that are motivating all of these circumstances. And then this notion that the index for black masculine anxieties is the gay black male. I mean, that is absolutely, totally unacceptable on a myriad of accounts, as though they are in so much special danger. And particularly when you contrast with Mr. Fuller, when we've had him on, where he talked about, that was 2009, where he said in his experience, if you were black and were effeminate, emasculated, were not out, trying to demonstrate what is stereotypically thought of as black masculinity, you would not be treated as bad by racists. You might get a job that another black person that is regarded as being stereotypically masculine would not get. You would be allowed in areas that other black male would not be. And that continues on today, where they have studies showing that if you were a black male and you didn't present as gay, there was a disparity between your income and the white male's income. If you were black and you publicized that you were gay, that disparity disappeared. You made the same amount of money as a white male. Explain that. That's what I'm saying. It's totally incorrect, and it goes against the trend that you see in the system of white supremacy. Even Mr. Fuller said that Little Richard said the reason that he behaved the way that he has done in his life as an entertainer, being flamboyant and high-pitched voice and everything, was exactly what Alison Mansell said. Don't be too manly. Don't be trying to talk with a deep, heavy bass in your voice and all of that, because that is going to make white people want to be more racist towards you. If you can go the opposite direction, they might treat you a little bit better. Mr. Fuller said Little Richard has explained this. Maybe he read Mr. Fuller's work. Continuing, some of the other things that stood out in the second audio.
Dr. Tommy Curry, he had talked about some of Eldridge Cleaver's writing on these subjects and how black males are emasculated. He talks a lot about that in Soul on Ice as well. And Dr. Curry talked about some of these other hidden manuscripts that he's including in his new book, Non-Man. I think it's not man or non-man, but it's coming out later this year. But he talks about, he analyzes that in some of Cleaver's ideas about how black males are systematically emasculated in a system of white supremacy, and him linking that to some of the homosexual behaviors that he was seeing in the prisons being encouraged. And particularly, you relate that to what we talked about with Sentenced to Science, Dr. Hoberman's book that was also mentioned in Medical Apartheid, where they were encouraging this homosexual activity. We even had some of the victims on the program where the paragraph where it says, contradicting Cleaver, Reed Farr suggests that the act of anal penetration, at least in the realm of memory, opens up space for the reconstruction of the black imaginary such that the most sacrosanct of black truths might be transgressed. I have no idea what that means. When we talk about metaphors, that is exactly what I'm talking about. People say things and they put these metaphors out there, and it might sound poetic. It might sound impressive. I know in some academic university settings, that sort of jargon and phraseology, that's an A+. That's a 4.0. When it comes to counter-racism, I have no idea what you're talking about if you're suggesting in any way, shape, or form that someone putting their male genitalia in the rectum of another male, that that somehow is constructive for victims of racism. That is absolutely absurd. I don't even know if I need to finish with the rest of the inability to creatively imagine homosexuality during slavery reflected a fundamental fear within the black collective of moving outside of the normative categories of masculinity, reproduction, pleasure, and family. It's not that I'm about mistreating someone who wants to engage in quote-unquote homosexual activity, regardless of what I think about it or its constructive value. I would simply say, if we are in a system of racism, white supremacy, what's going to be our priority? Let's say there was lots of quote-unquote homosexual activity amongst black males who were enslaved on the plantation. We can invest the next 50 years, the next 5 years, the next 5 days in investing and talking about that if, at the end of all that, we're going to have something that is going to help us solve the problem, racist man, racist woman, racist child. And I do not see that at all. That'll be something we can pay attention to as we roll in the book. I'll conclude there. That is our 3 hours, and that is the first study session on what I think will be a great book, great lead. Hopefully more people will have the book. If you don't have it, I think this will probably be a good one to have in hand so you can highlight and look up new terms and just make notes of things as we go. We'll be here same time next week, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. If you have commentary, if you want to write in, and we can read your commentary as we go, you can do so untiljustice@gmail.com. We'll be here tomorrow, compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, 6 p.m. Pacific. We'll review what has taken place over the past week. First full week, President Donald J. Trump was in office, amongst the other things that took place this past week. Looking forward to hearing from listeners, victims of racism, tomorrow evening. If you have any other questions, you can't find something in the archives, you want to help us upload content to the new SoundCloud account, drop us an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. With that, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I've seen no evidence that us being intoxicated, alcohol, cannabis, tobacco, any other narcotics, I've seen no evidence that any of those substances, toxins, poisons are going to help us replace white supremacy with justice. Dr. Welsing would want our brain computers functioning at optimal capacity. I think us being sober would be a great step in that direction. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
Problem. You're a victim. I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.